Interim Committee on Rural Policy meeting today, Monday, June 30th. It's amazing how quickly this summer is going by. A lot of informational stuff today, and I'm excited to hear from a number of them and to actually have an opportunity for other members on the committee who haven't been a part of some of these, including the update on the governor's task force, and hearing on the other one. So, again, it's really, they're all going to be just hearings. It'll be us if there's any real questions. We're not really going to open it up for a lot today because we have a very, very packed schedule. And I appreciate, though, if you have any questions or concerns after this meeting and you're here, please get any questions you have to any one of the people here and Representative Gilman, who is on the phone. And we welcome our representative from the distant portions of Oregon. So with that, I guess it might be worthwhile, because not everybody knows everybody that's here, just to introduce each ourselves. So we'll start way over to my right.
On the right. Far right.
It was just too easy. Vic Gilliam, I'm representing District 18, Silverton and Malala.
I'm Jean Cowan. I represent the Central Oregon Coast, primarily Lincoln County and pieces of others.
George, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm sorry?
Do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, yeah. George Gilman, District 55.
Thank you very much. I'm Arnie Roblin, District 9, and we'll let our staff go.
I'm Beth Herzog, I'm the committee administrator.
And our assistant?
I'm Debbie Roblin, committee assistant.
Thank you very much.
Welcome
so
more.
With that, we're going to get started. And we have some people who have tight deadlines, so we're going to start out with the likely effects of climate change on Oregon agriculture. So with that, we'll just open our little informational meeting. And be sure to introduce yourself.
I will do
that. Thanks.
Is this on? Okay. My name is Jeff Shaman. I'm a professor of climate and atmospheric sciences at Oregon State University. And I've been asked to talk about basically the IPCC report for you folks. Let me just get this up. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, issued this past a year ago, February, their State of the Climate Science. This is their fourth report, and they've done this on an irregular basis since the 90s, and the idea is to take as much as we know about the climate system and put it into a consensus document for the world essentially to use as a resource. The IPCC is done by the World Meteorological Organization and the United Nations Environmental Program. Anyone who's a member of these organizations, any country, can participate in it. Up to 120 countries do participate in it. The contributors are scientists, governmental officials. They act as contributors, authors, and reviewers. And the role of it, and I'm quoting this here because I just want to stick with what they do and what they say they're going to do, is to assess on a comprehensive, objective, and open and transparent basis the scientific, technical, and socioeconomic information relevant to the understanding of human-induced climate change and its risk, potential impacts of it, and options for adaptation and mitigation. The IPCC doesn't carry out the research itself. It draws on the peer-reviewed literature, published scientific and technical literature as well. It is also a consensus document, and what that means is that every author and member country on it has to agree to every word within it, and so by its nature, it tends to be very conservative. That is, it's not going to anything in either extremes in terms of what the scientific community is thinking on climate change and what the evidence is. So it's going to be more sort of a middle-of-the-road document. Some terminology. Now, all this stuff is available, by the way, at the IPCC's website, which is ipcc.ch, CH for Switzerland. They have a nice summary for policymakers. It's a 20-page document that's very approachable and readable if anybody wants to take a look at them themselves. They use some terminology, and they try to define it clearly. Climate change, they use to refer to any change in climate over time, whether it's due to natural variability or human-induced activities. There's also another term that I'm going to be talking about, so I'm going to define it here as they do. It's radiative forcing, and it's a measure of the influence of a factor has in altering the balance of incoming and outgoing energy in the Earth's atmosphere system. So if the planet is to change in temperature, basically it's just a bookkeeping exercise. Either there's more incoming than outgoing radiation or more outgoing than incoming radiation. If you have more incoming radiation than outgoing, the planet will warm up. Vice versa, it will cool down. Okay? So if you measure things in radiative forcing, you're putting it in terms of this large-scale global metric of what's going on with the planet's energy balance, which is ultimately what we're talking about when you're talking about global warming, right? So positive forcing, as they've defined it here, is something that's going to tend to warm the Earth's system, okay, specifically the planetary surface. Negative forcing is going to tend to cool it, and they reference all the values versus 1750, which is considered pre-industrial revolution, so before man was doing enough on a large enough scale to monkey around with the atmosphere and change levels of greenhouse gases, etc. So here's some of the data that they published. This is the drivers of climate change, and they talk about greenhouse gases. And you see these three plots on the right. The top one shows the change in carbon dioxide over the last 10,000 years. The middle one is methane, and the bottom one is nitrous oxide. All three of these are greenhouse gases. And what you can see is that they essentially hum along for about 10,000 years at approximately the same level. And then when you get to the very end over there, they shoot up dramatically over the last 250 years. It's very compressed because it's such a long length scale. What they say specifically in the report is that the concentrations of these gases have increased markedly as a result of human activities. They actually attribute the cause of it since 1750, and now far exceed pre-industrial values, and this is determined from ice cores. So you dig within ice cores, it's a record back through time in the Earth. There are little bubbles of air trapped in that, and it's representative of the atmosphere at the time that that snow fell. So we're able to reconstruct what the gas concentrations of the atmosphere were going back 10,000 years. So they talk about some of the drivers of this. If we look a little more closely at the carbon dioxide record, and you see that there's an inset there that just shows you from 1750 onward, and you see it's a little more gradual than that precipitous increase when you map it over 10,000 years. But the change in it has been from about 280 parts per million at the pre-industrial 1750 level to now 379 in 2005, which obviously was 3 years ago. And this concentration exceeds by far the natural range over the last 650,000 years. If you were to plot this back further, again using ice cores and other reconstructive records, you'd see some oscillations in it between 180 parts per million and 300 parts per million, but never any excursion this far nor this quickly. The primary source of this increased atmospheric concentration of CO2 is the result of fossil fuel burnings. That's what they've attributed to. Land use provides another significant but smaller contribution. If we look at methane, it's a very similar story. We've gone from about 715 parts per billion, that's what the PPB stands for, to 1774 parts per billion in 2005, so over a doubling of that. And again, this by far exceeds the natural range that was recorded in these records of ice cores over the last 650,000 years. They say it is very likely, and what that means by that is that they agree there's a greater than 90% chance that the observed increase in methane is due to anthropogenic activities, predominantly agriculture and fossil fuel use, but the relative contributions of these are not well determined. This is another plot that's from the summary. It shows the different radiative forcings of various actors in this whole climate change scenario that we're witnessing right now with our planet. And our understanding of what's going on with this has improved considerably, but there's still error bars on it, and there's still some factors that we don't understand very well. But our certainty is enough that they say within the IPCC with very high confidence that the globally averaged net effect of human activities since 1750 has been one of warming. And they actually quantify that radiative forcing in terms of watts per meter square as plus 1.6. So that's a warming of the surface. And again, very high confidence is defined as having a 90% chance of being correct. If we can look at some of the other individual players within this, the combined radiative forcing due to increases in carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide is about 2.3 watts per meter squared. And you can see there's some error ranges there between 2.07 and 2.53. It's not a very wide range of error. That's because we know this one with some considerable amount of certainty. Some of the other factors we don't know quite as well, but we can say that it's very likely, again, 90% probability, that this type of increase is unprecedented in the last 10,000 years. Again, you can go back to those figures where we see how quickly it shoots up compared to what was going on in the previous 10,000 years. If you look at some of the other players in the system, anthropogenic aerosols, these are things like sulfate, organic carbon, black carbon, nitrate, and dust, these tend to act typically in a cooling fashion. And our understanding of what they do is better, but they remain the dominant uncertainty in our understanding of what's going to happen as we monkey around with the planet. There are other contributors as well, things like tropospheric ozone, halocarbons, changes in surface albedo, and they have various smaller effects on it, and these are all things that you can peruse at your leisure if you were to look at the report. So one of the things that they did in this fourth assessment that they hadn't done previously is that they attribute climate change. And what their statement is that most of the observed increase in globally average temperature since the mid-20th century is very likely, again, greater than 90% probability, due to observed increases in anthropogenic greenhouse gas concentrations. So there's now discernible human influence that extends to other aspects of the climate, including ocean warming, continental average temperatures, temperature extremes, and wind patterns. These are some plots here. They show, the black lines show observations every decade, average for each decade for the globe, global land, global ocean, and six of the seven continents. And around this, it shows you model simulations, that's what the colors are, trying to represent what's happened over the last century. This is 20th century. The blue smears is the range that models get if all they put into the models is natural forcing, things like solar variability, volcanic activity that affect the planet and temperatures on it. And what you can see is that particularly for the latter portion of the 20th century, they're unable to capture that excursion of extreme warming that you see in all those plots. The pink range is when they actually also include anthropogenic effects. Fossil fuel burning, agricultural use, land use changes, changes in aerosols. And what you can see is that it's a much better capture of what's going on. So without inclusion of anthropogenic effects, you cannot capture the observed record in these global climate models. Here's some direct observational evidence of it. The warming of the climate system is fairly unequivocal. You can see rises in the global mean temperature, rise in the sea level as the oceans warm and the glaciers melt, and decreases in northern hemisphere snow cover. If you were to look at some individual aspects of it, mountain glaciers, these are also decreasing generally. If you see those red spots are areas where, in fact, the glaciers are thinning. Okay, and the larger they are and the darker they are, the more they thin. And most of the alpine glaciers in the world seem to be thinning. Greenland and Antarctica have also very likely contributed to sea level rise due to their melting over the last 10 years, they assessed. There's also concern about what's going on in the Arctic. They pay a lot of attention to this. It's a bit of a canary in the coal mine. It's increased in temperatures at twice the globally average rate over the past 100 years and is projected to continue to outpace the rest of the globe. It's also seen not only in the temperature record, but also in the sea ice record over the Arctic Ocean. And in fact, as many of you are well aware, the North Pole was actually ice-free for a moment. I think it was 2 years ago. Was it 2 years ago? Last year? Was it last year? There's also observational evidence that there are changes going on to the hydrologic cycle. There's more intense and longer droughts have been observed than previously recorded. And this increased drying is linked with both higher temperatures and decreased precipitation. And this doesn't happen everywhere. Certain areas of the globe are going to have increased precipitation and certain areas are going to have decreased precipitation. However, there's a frequency of heavy precipitation events is anticipated to actually increase. It's sort of an intensification of the hydrologic cycle and the energetics of all the weather systems floating around the planet, and it results in periods of abatement in precipitation and then deluges. So they also can use these climate models that we have to actually project what's going to go on in the future. And all the scenarios that they run, when I say scenarios, you have to project what humans are actually going to do, what kind of greenhouse gas concentration, sulfates, etc., we're going to dump into the atmosphere. So they run a range of scenarios, and they run it through many different models, and they get an ensemble average for each of these scenarios. And what you see is that regardless of the scenario, over the next 20 years, it were expected to go have an increase of 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade. Depending on the scenario you run, it's likely that those temperatures are going to continue to increase, and very likely, according to the IPCC, again, greater than 90% probability that the changes in temperature are going to exceed those that we saw in the 20th century. So we're expecting to see even larger increases in temperature over the next 100 years. So there's some more information on the projections of future climate change. You can look at this also at your leisure. I don't have too much time. The projections of future climate change you can also see in a distributed fashion. This shows you surface temperature changes. Shows you 20-year window period from 10-year period from 2029 in the middle layer, and then the right layer it shows you at the end of the century for the last 10 years. And it shows you the changes in temperature that are anticipated, and you can see that at the higher latitudes, and particularly the Arctic, northern Canada, northern Europe, and Asia, they're supposed to get much more increases in temperature than at lower latitudes. You can also look at this to see changes in polar ice caps and changes in precipitation. There's less certainty in what's going to go on there, but there's anticipated, as I said, to be some areas that will have increases in precipitation and other areas not so much. But changes in rainfall patterns are expected. The last thing I'll say is that with all the feedbacks and complexity of the climate system, the IPCC had previously been reluctant to say what the actual effect of a doubling of CO2 is. As a metric, people often think of CO2, but they now are able to say with some certainty, they were able to agree upon this, that it was likely, and here they define likely as a greater than 66% probability, to be in the range of 2 to 4.5 degrees Celsius, with the best estimate of about 3 degrees Celsius, and very unlikely that if you were to double CO2 from where it is, that you would have a warming of less than a degree and a half. Okay? So I will leave it at that.
Okay. Any questions about this portion? Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I'll remind people, if you're out there, cell phones should be turned off. It sounds like everybody's done that, so I'm feeling pretty good. I haven't heard any feedback on our system yet. But
okay, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Ann Nolan. I'm a professor, associate professor in the Department of Geosciences at Oregon State University. My areas of research and interest are in snow and ice in the climate system. I'm also the associate director of the Water Resources Science graduate program at Oregon State University, and so I'm very interested in climate change and water on a regional basis, as well as climate change even in the Arctic and far-flung places. And today I'm going to be talking about impacts on water resources, mostly from a snow hydrologist perspective. I'll start out by showing a plot that was generated by Iris Stewart back in 2005. And these different circles show, the red circles show that the peak of snowmelt stream flow is occurring earlier, and the dark blue circles are showing that it's occurring later in the season, and this is attributed to, the red circles are attributed to earlier snowmelt. And you'll notice there's a couple of funny blue dots in Oregon, and I thought, that does not seem consistent with the rest of the United States, because we know that Oregon is, or the rest of the West, Oregon is very, has very warm snowpacks, always falling and accumulating close to 0 degrees Celsius. So I actually had a grad student redo this and found that, in fact, that we do resemble a lot of the rest in, west, a lot of the rest of the western U.S. And what we see here in the headwaters of the Mackenzie River, that, in fact, the timing of springtime flow now occurs about 15 days, a little more than 2 weeks, since 1950s. And then in the Deschutes, it's about 18 days earlier over the same period of time. The graph in the lower right is showing the Mackenzie River at Clear Lake. And so, in fact, what you see is that ultimately when you get down to low flows in the summer, that you have a lower amount of water available during the driest, hottest time of the season in both of these high elevation watersheds. And ultimately that will have an impact on flows elsewhere. Some work that I did, published a couple of years ago with my colleague Chris Daly, shows the areas in red that are considered at-risk snow. And this is snow that's at risk of turning into rain, essentially, when it falls. And that's in the core winter months. So if we have a 2 degree increase in temperature, 2 degrees Celsius increase in temperature in December, January, February, you might expect with high probability that these areas in red would be falling as rain and not snow. And that would, again, be impacting these watersheds that are primarily snow-dominated, these high-elevation watersheds. And it doesn't look like much of the area is at risk, except that it's all concentrated in the Olympic Range and in the Oregon Cascades. 22% of the area that's now covered by snow, that normally we would have snowfall, would be rain, falling as rain instead of snow. But it's not just all about climate. we have very interesting geology here, and it turns out that if you look at these orange areas on the map, those are the high cascades, those young volcanic rocks, and all those watersheds are groundwater dominated. So you'd think, well, hey, it doesn't really matter if the precipitation falls as rain or as snow. It's all just going to go in, right? Well, that's not the case. It turns out that these groundwater-dominated watersheds are a lot more sensitive to small changes in snowpack because they have this long recession limb, this long decline during the dry season. And so any small change during the year, during the time of year when you have precipitation results in a much lower endpoint, ultimately lower low flows than you'd have before. And so when we make these kinds of predictions, projections, we want to consider not just climate, but where these things are happening. So our mountains are really quite diverse in terms of their geology, and that affects what's going on with our water quite distinctly. And here's an example of that. This is one of these groundwater-dominated watersheds. This is that Clear Lake headwaters area of the Mackenzie River. And you see the light gray line is from mid-century of the last century, and you can see that peak then has shifted earlier if you look at the period for 2001-2005, the solid black line, and that's that shift of about a little over 2 weeks. You can see ultimately the low flows down there in September are lower, and they are lower consistently throughout the summer than they used to be for this high elevation watershed. And then we used a model to project into the future based on, again, these climate projections from the IPCC models. And you'll see in that dashed line what you might see in on the order of 50, 60 years with a 2-degree warming. You would see a lot of that snow falling as rain. And that's where you get these really high peaks in the middle of winter. So you're going to be increasing your flood hazard potential, and you're also going to be ultimately having lower low flows throughout the rest of the year. So one of the other things I was looking at is the melting of glaciers, and here you can see this is a photo of Elliott Glacier from 1901 by Harry Fielding Reid, and here's another picture in 2006 by Daryl Lloyd, and you can see this Elliott Glacier on the north side of Mount Hood is quite a bit smaller, and you think, well, so what? It's not really that big a deal. It's a really small watershed, and only about 6.8% of that watershed is covered by glaciers, and in fact, if you look at the whole Hood River watershed, it's really less than, it's on the order of maybe half a percent, if that, of the entire watershed is covered by glaciers. So it shouldn't really matter, should it? Well, it turns out that for the irrigation districts, it does, because they take their water out of the streams fairly high up. And the higher you get, the more contribution those glaciers has to their total flow, especially in the hottest, driest time of the year where no other source of water is available to these guys. All you get in the streams is really what's coming off of the glaciers. But we knew anecdotally that that was the case, but no one really had spent any time measuring the glacier contributions to the upper Middle Fork, and we got a small amount of money from USGS to look at this, and we quantified this at the glacier terminus, and you can see one of the measuring sites there. And then we also measured it lower down just before the irrigation district takes their water out through their diversion. We did this for a couple of different glaciers. We made stream flow and isotope measurements. You can see my grad student here collecting ice samples to make some isotope measurements. And these help us identify where the water came from, how much of the water actually came from the glaciers and how much is from groundwater. And it turns out that for Elliott and Coe Creeks, both of these are fed by glaciers, on the order of about 88% of the water coming down at the diversions is from the glaciers. Lower down, where you have two other creeks coming in that aren't fed by glaciers, it's still about 3/4 of the upper Middle Fork Hood River is coming from glacier melt in August at that driest, hottest time of the year when irrigation is so important. And so we also wanted to know what might be happening in about 50 years, and we used current recession rates for the glacier and shrunk the glacier artificially. And there you can kind of see the outline of the glacier on the right, and those different colors represent the different elevation of the glacier, with brown being the lowest and blue being the highest. And then that little stippled inset is the smaller glacier, what we might anticipate it to look like in about 50 years using the current rates of recession. And then the plot on the bottom there, the blue dashed line is what we see, what we measured in discharge coming out of the glacier, and then the dashed line is the 2059 scenario. And what we found is that the glacier meltwater contributions to the upper Middle Fork for those irrigation districts will decrease by about 1/3. And that's a fairly conservative estimate. So one of the things we think about, my students and I and my colleagues at OSU and our water groups there, we want to know, well, what kind of changes, how do we know what's happening with our water resources in the future? Are we measuring things in the right way, in the right place? And we're convinced that we have really incomplete measurement systems. Our observation systems were designed for something else, not for looking at climate change. Our stream gauges are being discontinued. Typically, they're located below dams, so we're not able to monitor natural flow. You can reconstruct natural flow, but it's oftentimes quite difficult to do. And this plot on the left is a map of all the dams in the Willamette and Deschutes watersheds. This is a more detailed look at the Willamette Basin, and the red areas are the so-called at-risk snow. The blue is the snow that's considered not at risk, but might actually increase if we have more precipitation over a shorter period of time in the winter. That's the high elevation snow. But again, we have a very, very limited system of snowpack measurements, these NRCS snowtell sites. So I would argue that we really need to be measuring snowpacks where they're changing now and where we anticipate them to be changing over the next 50 years. These snowtell sites were primarily put in the 80s, and I would argue that we have already a climate that is different from that in the 80s, and these are not representative of snow, and they were also put in for a different purpose, not for measuring climate change. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? So I guess the biggest thing that I'm hearing then is the availability of water, especially at the high flow levels, is, if the models are correct, will decrease that amount of water that we would have.
We don't even need a model to show that.
Exactly.
We already see it in the data. We see in the dry time of the year, we have lower low flows, and we have a longer period of recession, and we have earlier peak flows.
And the other thing that is pretty evident is that we will have higher high water flood events more often and earlier, because they aren't going to stay in the snow. It isn't going to stay as snow. It's going to come when it comes in rain.
That's correct.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Stella Cookley. I'm an Associate Dean at the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to provide information on what Oregon might expect to see in regards to climate change and its impact on the agricultural sector, an important aspect of the rural economy. My PhD is in plant pathology, and I've worked since the mid-1970s on possible effects of climate change on plant pathogens and the disease they cause, and tracked more generally on the likely impacts on other pest species. However, today I'm going to comment on more broadly on the agricultural issues overall. I would like to acknowledge my colleagues for setting the stage for my part of the session. The most important and limiting factor for agriculture in Oregon will be the availability of a sufficient quantity of water of sufficient quality for the needed purposes. And obviously associated with water is not only whether you can store it, but the cost of moving it from where it may be stored or providing it when it is needed. I have provided copies of the Agricultural Progress magazine, which was a special edition with water issues in Oregon, as a reference for those of you who may not have seen it yet. It's not all bad news as far as global warming, at least for Oregon. If water is sufficient, it could be actually good news for some areas, because there will be warmer temperatures and more favorable growing conditions for some crops. If you look at the U.S. overall, the impact is not all that great on average, as long as you happen to be in an area in which things are getting better as opposed to an area where things are getting worse, which is always the trick of the matter. The current estimate is that the range is going to be somewhere between a loss of a quarter billion to a gain of $5 billion. This is on a U.S. overall by the year 2030. I would like to acknowledge and thank John Antle of Montana State University for the information that's provided on this slide. Dr. Antle will be joining the Faculty of Agriculture Resource Economics at Oregon State University in 2009. There are going to be very important regional differences, and it's very hard to say with certainty exactly what those will be, especially in regards to precipitation. That is the most difficult one to predict from year to year, or even from week to week, season to season. The estimates are that there will be losses in the south where it will be hotter and drier, somewhat mixed in the Midwest, mostly positive in the Pacific Northwest, assuming adequate water availability when and where needed. Climate variability is expected to increase with more extreme events, those living in zones of hurricanes, floods, I think feel that very acutely. Climate change and the impacts are going to have a more serious impact on perennial crops, which would be of concern to in Oregon, certainly, than on the annual cropping systems where you can trade your crops out from year to year more readily. So your perennial crops, vineyards, orchards, grass seed fields, may be more difficult because you may be running more on the edge of stress in years as you go through this transition to a warmer climate. There are also multi-year investments. Those crops being grown on the margin, i.e. on the edge of where they can suitably thrive, are going to be subject to more impact. When crops are stressed, whether they're annuals or perennials, they're more subject to infection by plant diseases or attacks by insects or being overcome by weedy species. And perennials seem to be particularly susceptible to multi-year stresses. Animals raised in closed environments or open ranges may likewise be impacted by a shift in climate, again, assuming availability of water. The impact may be modest. There are also severe implications for the fisheries and wildlife aspects of Oregon's economy. And I'm going to turn to something that is sort of dramatic, and I think is maybe why I'm here before you today. When we testified to the House on energy and the environment, I had the good fortune of having borrowed some material from a colleague, Greg Jones, Dr. Greg Jones at Southern Oregon University, who is internationally known for his work on varieties of wine and the suitability of climate for wine, particular kinds of wine. So the slides I'm going to show you were shared with Greg on the condition they not be further distributed. They reflect material that has not yet been published and is therefore will be copyrighted by Dr. Jones. I'm very grateful for this, because if there's anything that might get your attention as to what does this mean for Oregon, this would be it. What I'm going to show you is a series of slides that sort of show the temporal special changes in growing degree days, and this is based on data from 1980 to 2003, and just giving you a little chance to look where you have white, the region is too cold or too hot, where you have red, you're in a region where you're sort of really on the hot side for bulk table grapes. Those of you familiar with California would recognize the San Joaquin Valley, which is blaring in red. So here would be the Napa Valley up on the coast of California, the Willamette Valley, and the Walla Walla Valley. And these are the different regions. So we're largely in the Willamette Valley in Region 1. Now, what you're going to observe here would be the changes of colors. You suddenly see that the San Joaquin Valley of California becomes too hot for any bulk wine and table grapes. And you start seeing more favorable conditions up in, particularly in the Walla Walla Valley. You again see, then for 3 degree, take a look at California. You discover that their grape growing ability is pretty well marginalized. And certainly the grapes that they will be growing are going to be largely for bulk varieties.
Now, if you look at why does this matter, there is a very close connection between what varieties of grapes and what type of wines can be made, and there are climate thresholds. And along the bottom, you see the climate metrics, the growing season, average temperature, heat accumulation, or drought stress metrics. You can almost label these axes as you want. What you end up seeing is, as you move across this, an optimal period and then a less than optimal. When it's too cold, you have lower sugar levels, unripe flavors, they're unbalanced. If it's too warm, you have lower retention of acids, overripe flavors, again, unbalanced. Then you have your optimum zone, consistent sugar levels, ripe flavors, generally balanced, vintage variations driven by seasonal climate factors, frost, untimely rains, etc. Then you have your optimal zone. And so you can define your varieties and their zones at what their optimal is. And then you ideally have varieties that may have some plasticity and adaption. Now, that's short-term. Varietal is long-term. You're talking about a multi-year investment here. So as you look at what happens then, in a warmer climate, you're going to cause a shift in the types of crops that can be grown in specific regions, in this case, the example being grapes and what specific varieties. So you're going to have your zones shift to the coast, the north, and to higher elevations. And if you look over on the right, what you're seeing there are different models predicting what is going to happen. And, you know, if it's blue, it's better, and if it's red, it's worse. And then there's going to be a combination of temperature and then issues of soil moisture, what's available, again, coming back to your precipitation availability. In this next and last slide, what you have are the common varieties or a list of a large number of the varieties of wine that you probably are accustomed to drinking. We have for the Willamette Valley, currently the green line is the average. It's sitting just between this 55, 59, 60, 63. Look to the right, the red line, the 2.3, if you had that as an increase, that would be the varieties of varieties of wine that would be more common in the Willamette Valley. If you look for the southern Oregon, average now is already substantially warmer, almost 3 degrees warmer than the Willamette Valley. You add another 2.5 degrees, suddenly you're over getting rapidly into the table grape area. And then if you look for eastern Oregon and move up into the Walla Walla area, you're going to have much less acreage available for your wine grapes. So with that, I would close by just saying that there is a key uncertainty here, which is what is the rate going to be on climate change. And to some degree, we can help with technology. Hopefully for the longer term, we can do sufficient research to help compensate. And most certainly, it's not all negative if we can provide water at an affordable price and availability for agricultural use. And with that, questions?
And welcome.
Yeah. Thank you. Cut her a little late.
That's okay. Any questions here? I guess my biggest one is that it is about water and storage of that water and having it available at different times. But also for our other stuff that we raise in Oregon, if we aren't going to have that as predictable, is that going to change our forest health? The southern regions as well?
Actually, I think we're already seeing some changes. Swiss needle casts, a disease that was for many years not a particular problem here, has become a much greater problem as a result of additional precipitation, change of precipitation patterns. You would expect there to be an impact on forest health for the longer term. Most certainly in the regions where things dry out and you have the great challenge of managing undergrowth where there's been overgrowth for many years, and then the prediction would be there will be more wildfires, that is going to put its own set of stressors on for the forest situation.
So in talking about wildfires, the California group, the 1,000 fires they've had in the last couple months, related to this global warming, they're supposed to be getting it sooner than us with regard to some of that. Any idea, or is that just our natural factors of wildfires and abundant stuff on the forest floor?
Jeff, do you have any?
You can come on up, yeah.
There is a publication that came out 2 years ago by Tony Westerling, that showed since the 1980s, just over the last two decades, that wildfires have increased in size, number, frequency, and intensity, and that this was caused not by forest management practices as well, I mean, that was part of the issue, but largely in response to an earlier earlier reduction of snowmelt. So snow's melting earlier in the spring. You have a longer dry season. And so those fuels have a longer period to dry out. And so by the time you get to that summer thunderstorm period, you get more lightning-caused fires. And normally the fire fuels wouldn't be as dry, but it's because of a longer dry period. So that's already been documented, and the projections for that, Ron Nielsen has done some of these projections, have been for a continuation of this increase in the size, frequency, intensity of forest fires. And combine that with stresses from invasive pests that you see a weakening of the forest health and decline in forest health overall that can lead to even bigger forest fires.
And I guess my other question that goes back, and I'll go to yours because it was directed to your slides. Both the groundwater system, at least in eastern Oregon, the eastern side of the Cascades, and on the western side, the availability of water, i.e. our reservoirs, our biggest reservoirs have been the Cascades for both sides. The impact on refilling the aquifers, you're saying it's going to run off rather than slowly drip in, if I looked at those correctly. So we're not going to recharge as well on the east side, and we're not going to store as long on the west side.
That's correct.
And so we either have to figure out other ways to get water into those aquifers on the east side and ways to store it on the west side if we want to have available resources.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. Yes, Representative Cowan.
Thank you. The comparatives on grape growing are very interesting. And if I'm looking at them correctly, there is anticipated to be a period of time where Oregon could be a terrific producer of certain kinds of wines. Is that...
Well, hopefully it will be a terrific producer of many wines for a long time to come.
Well, absolutely. But I mean, there was a period of time when you would anticipate getting too hot in California and warming some in greater parts of Oregon.
Correct. And actually, one of the greatest concerns with sort of looking at the larger, longer-term view, anyone who, as most of us did, just came through the winter we came through with a particularly exceptionally high snowpack, and one that blessedly did not melt early, as it often happens. And that's wonderful, and we should treasure those years when we have them. The extreme piece, and of course that's what makes it so hard to predict what is going to happen. Certainly, as long as there is water to be had, the edge is on managing, like the grapes and the vineyards, you're in reasonable shape. All of us get a little nervous come September, October, particularly this year, because my cherry tree is running pretty late. But if you're growing wine, grapes, you can just hope that we will have a late summer, warm fall. I think that the more progressive growers already are paying attention and thinking about what varieties they are going to be planting, and this is where Greg Jones and his expertise is. I would have to refer anyone wondering to speak with him, because this is what he effectively does, is consult for those who are trying to figure out what they're going to plant where.
If I could follow up, where my mind is playing around at the moment, as I know that many of us have a lot of concerns about water and finding better ways to store or recharge or to have it available, we actually have the potential of there being some quite good agricultural years ahead for Oregon if there were adequate water and temperatures rose just a little bit. But at the same time, that then causes us to think a little bit from the planning perspective as to the amount of land we have available for that agriculture projection. Or am I just kind of wandering off on a tangent here? It's kind of all rolls together in my mind. I'm thinking about some things.
No, actually, I think that's astute consideration. And then if one were to follow with, okay, how do you position oneself to be as competitive as possible to utilize the water and the favorable growing conditions for economic vitality? And I think part of it goes into trying to make now an investment in the necessary research to look at water-saving technologies specifically for agriculture, but it's also about cleaning up water and being able to safely reuse it. It's about removing both human, animal, plant pathogens from water to be able to, say, put it back on a nursery crop or to put it back on some production site safely so that it will work. And I think the investments in research in the next short number of years could pay off dividends in our ability to forestall the natural tension between use of water for human consumption versus water for production. My sense is that we've made progress with water technologies, but you only have to look not too far at all to the east and up in the Hermiston area to see where they're already producing agricultural crops at what's called negative water deficit. The downside to that type of production is you don't get a recharging of aquifers nearly to the degree you do if you're doing effectively sprinkler or ditch irrigation, where you have a lot more water that goes back into the system. So I think it has to be a balancing, though, of trying to figure out how you're going to best use the water you have. Obviously, a lot of our water still is headed out to the ocean. Well, that's good for the fish, but it's a balancing act, and we can do much better with conservation in terms of making sure we can use as much water as possible, most effectively as possible.
I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting we not proceed with some of our efforts to control the global warming issues, but maybe we could take advantage of in the middle until we get things cooled off.
I think the advantage of using our very best thinking to get as much as we can mileage out of, I think for the longer term, if you look internationally, international challenges, it's going to be water and it's going to be food.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the only thing else that I would say is we will probably get a hold of some of you about ideas that you mentioned today. One is, where would we put more research technology to measure the right kinds of things that we haven't been measuring? And it's something that the committee may want to look at as a proposal that we as a committee might even introduce. So if you have some of those suggestions, we will get back in touch with you about the kinds of things we think are necessary and the costs of those. So thank you. Thank you very much. So we'll close our informational meeting on the likely effects of climate change, and we will open a public hearing on the update from the Task Force Federal Forest Payments and County Services. And as many as you want to come up.
Am I going to be just really depressed by the end of the day?
Well, you already found the goodness in the last piece.
Well, better agriculture. I'm having a little more difficulty with this one.
Yeah, this was a... You know, I want to, while we're getting ready, as having been a member of this task force, a lot of people worked very, very hard to see what we could do, and I think what we found out fairly clearly is that by ourselves we're going to have a difficult time solving this problem. I think you can go right over there in the corner, too, or right up on the dais a little higher, if it can get up high enough. If you can actually stick that on the desk, on the dais. Yeah, it's... It needs to go the other direction. I'm thinking right up on top of the... Yeah,
so
right
the
there.
Grapes will be good for a while.
Well,
I
switch from the other one.
I don't like
it. Take it from me, you can have it.
I'm actually going to get it all off.
And Senator, did you get your name tagged? Do people
Most
know who you
assuredly.
Are? You can introduce yourself.
Fred Zerrett, Senate District 9. I appreciate you inviting me to be here.
And Senator was also one of the members of this task force, so I appreciate his. He was there every meeting, even though I missed a couple. He was there, so. And a past member of our illustrious committee here.
This is a good committee.
So with that, turn it over to our.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt. I'm the governor's deputy chief of staff, and I chaired the task force on federal forest payments and county services. And with me is.
Chair Roland Bobby Green, Lane County Commissioner, and also co-chair of the task force.
Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties.
And as you know, we delivered our initial report to the governor, and we have Marvin Brown joining us as well, last Monday. And it was the product of 6 months of meetings and full task force meetings, work group meetings. I know those of you who were on the task force with us appreciate how much work went into this. And I want to begin, we'll organize our report and presentation around the slides you'll be seeing, hopefully momentarily. You had the slide packs in front of you. But again, we got a glimpse of what we might be in for a year ago when there was the extended delay in the reauthorization of the Secure Rural Schools Act. And at that point, the governor, later in the year last year, asked us to convene this task force and look at what can be done at all levels, county, state, and federal governments. We spent the most of our time looking at ways in which the state can assist the counties with the delivery of shared services, those which are jointly financed and jointly delivered. But we touched on all aspects of the problem. So I'll begin by pointing out that in quantifying the impact of the loss of these funds, we looked at both Title I, which flows to the counties as either general fund dollars from the BLM lands, mostly ONC lands, Title I, which flows from the Forest Service lands to both counties and schools, 75% and 25%, respectively, and also Title III funds, which flow from both lands, which are used for forest stewardship and emergency management services on forest lands. We do not include Title II, which pretty much remains in federal accounts, although it's also an important part of the management of federal forest lands and adjacent forest lands. Quantifying all that and looking at what would be left in the form of traditional harvest receipts, what are we to lose the Secure Rural Schools payments, and we come up with a $206 million loss in the coming fiscal year and a $32 million for counties. That's roughly half in general funds and half in road funds, and $32 million per year in money that now flows to schools. There you see the representation of those numbers on the bar graphs with the red bars there representing what will be left payments that come in the form of the traditional harvest receipts from the logging on federal forest lands. The blue line is what's at stake. And the net of the two is that $206 million for counties and $32 million for schools. By way of comparison, we look back to the 2001-03 period when the state, as you very well know, many of you lived through it and managed through it, went through its worst budget shortfall since the Great Depression, actually the worst loss of the worst two-year loss of state revenue since the 1930s. That was a 20% loss of revenue from what had been forecasted. It was a 13% loss of revenue, again, the state experience, from the prior biennium. And when you actually got down to patching together your budget, you dealt with a 9% hole because you found other one-time funds. Look at the impact on the hardest hit counties. We identified 24 counties. We started by looking at those which would suffer more than a 20% loss of either general funds or road funds. And you see the magnitude of the impact there, where the average for those counties is a loss of 26% of their discretionary general funds versus what they had last year. So that compares to the 13% loss the state experienced from one biennium to the next. 26% loss, twice as severe for county general funds, and a 39% loss for these 24 counties for their road funds. So a much worse problem in terms of proportion and impact for the counties than it was for the state in that 2001-03 period. We want to call attention as well to the impact on schools, and want to dispel the notion that this is a problem, a financial problem, which is isolated to rural counties. Now, school districts are not seeing an actual loss of funding for next year, but they are foregoing $32 million. And that'll spread to every school district in the state, although the initial loss impacts the rural schools, primarily in those 24 counties we identified. Because of the way the school funding formula works, it'll be picked up and spread statewide. So every school district in the state will have $58 less per student than they otherwise would have had the secure rural schools payments continued. And we also quantified there the impact in the Tri-County area, which I think deserves some attention. Here you also see how the impact will be experienced for those counties hard hit in their general funds. Josephine County losing about 60% to 70% of their general fund discretionary revenues. Douglas County over 60%, Curry County right at 60%, and on down. Those marked in red are the ones we've marked as hard hit counties on their general fund impacts. The next slide shows the counties suffering a 20% loss or greater in their road funds. And there you see both Southern Oregon and Eastern Oregon heavily represented. Again, the road funds come from receipts from the Forest Service lands, not the BLM lands. And that's why you see such a representation of the Eastern Oregon counties there as well. We were aided in our task force by John Krosick, who's the administrator of Yamhill County, who did a lot of assembling and analysis of the data. And when it came right down to it, he looked at large, medium, and small, and very small counties, and looked at the amount of revenue, general fund revenue per capita they now receive, and that which he estimates to be required to run a county at a minimal level. And he has his own experience from Yamhill County, where I think the number is about $160 per capita. Now, this is not in any way a robust budget. Matter of fact, what Mr. Krosick told us was that at this level, at $160 per capita, which is where Yamhill County will be without its share, and it's not a hard-hit county, but its modest share of the secure rural schools payments, Yamhill will be able to, and I'm quoting Mr. Krosick, be able to support only 20 sheriff's deputies and no libraries at $160 per capita. So we had to draw a line at some point to get an estimate of which counties just really cannot continue to provide the basic services of public safety, public health, and maintain their roads. And these were the best guess bottom line numbers, so to speak, for what it takes to run a county, which enters into our later analysis of which counties we are going to be telling you are critical, or which counties, even if they have reserves, will eventually end up in unsustainable situations where they can't pay for even the minimal level of services. So the next page in the map is further, the map on the placard there is further demonstration of this, shows you which counties earned a critical designation because they're going to be falling below that line within 2 to 4 years, depending on how long it takes them to exhaust their reserves. And, Mike, do you want to add anything to that analysis?
Well, those counties which we are calling in crisis are entering into that budget period now with this fiscal 08-09 budget. The hard-hit counties generally have some reserve or other source of revenue which allow them to put off that crisis until a year or two or three in some cases down the road.
The ones colored red on the map, the crisis counties, are Josephine, Curry, Lane, Polk, Columbus, Columbia, and Klamath for their general funds. The others are color red because of the impact on their road funds. And then you have Coos, Grant, and Douglas which we identify as unsustainable. They're about 2 to 3 to 4 years away from being in the same situation once they draw down reserves. In our report, we document for you the extent of reserves, and during our task force presentations, you saw an actual detail of all the reserves that are being held by the counties. And some have done a good job of shepherding their resources, but even so, they're not going to be able to survive for more than a few years, 4 to 5 years at most, without the continuation of these payments. With that, I thought maybe we could shift now for you to hear a little bit more about the experience county by county. And Bobby Green, who co-chaired our task force and is on the Lane County Commission, can start with that. Is that right? Or Mike, you want to start?
And then Bobby. I'd like to, Mr. Chair, members of the committee and alumni, I'd like to refer you to the Exhibit A portion of the report. And I'd also first like to say, of course, of Mike MacArthur Association of Oregon Counties, that I think if there's a bright spot in all this at all, it's this work that's been done to compile this report and this documentation of really the state-county relationship and how services are provided on behalf of the citizens by the state and counties. And I really want to compliment Tim Nesbitt for driving this, leading this process, and for the work that some of my staff's done, Laura Cleland and Eric Schmidt, and on the graphic representations of that data. I think we have here is a really good explanation for helping people understand how this all works. And this Exhibit A talks about some of the specific impacts to counties that you're seeing now. And I think it's important to walk you a little bit through the chart. If you look at Baker County, first page, the top box shows the estimated general fund general funds available. And the important box, I think, is the fourth one over, where it shows the percent of loss, and the third one over, $308 per person. That's the revenue per capita that's available to Baker County. Baker County, in this particular instance, takes a really hard hit in the roads because they don't get these payments for general fund, and the amount of actual road funding per mile, which I think is another significant measure we've come up with in this report, shows $5,836, which is the third lowest in the state. Now, if you'll go forward to take a look at a couple of counties you're familiar with, Cherobland, Coos County, a couple more back. Those same figures show a 39.8% loss of general fund, which would mean you would be at $155 of revenue per capita for general fund, and road funds at a 12.7% loss. These are the bottom boxes, the right side, and $15,000. Per road mile. That's because Coos has a little bit of reserve and they have the county forest. So they're a little bit better off on the roadside. But Coos County has also managed into this situation by making the cuts last year. So they'll be able to sustain a little bit longer. Going forward in the report a little further, if you looked at Josephine County, one of the leading crisis counties. Now remember those revenue per capita figures again. Josephine County's estimated discretionary revenue without the safety net is $80 per person, roughly half of what our analysis says is necessary to run a functioning county. And then they lose a 28% loss in the road fund, but their balance ending per road mile is fairly high again because of reserves. But of course, you can't use those reserves to pay for general fund operations. Klamath County, Representative Gilman, you may not have this document if you're hearing me. Klamath County takes a 20% loss in general fund, 50% loss in roads. Klamath has one of the greater reserves available.
He didn't respond.
Did we want to check on?
Is he still here
with us?
Representative Gilman?
I'm not sure.
We've lost him.
Okay, we'll try to call him back.
Okay. One other point I wanted to make, Representative Gillum, you represent Clackamas County.
Yes.
And although Clackamas County doesn't make the hardest hit list, their actual losses are $10 million. It's because of the size of Clackamas County, the relative proportion of that loss doesn't rise to the level of some of these others, but it's a significant amount, in $5.3 million in their road fund. Makes a big difference. Lincoln County, another example of hard hit in the road fund, losing 60%, and that translates to a lot of positions that will be lost. They've also tried to manage this over time, but they'll be losing, they've eliminated 18 of 48 positions already, and will be losing more of those in the future. I think it might be illustrative for Commissioner Green to talk about Lane County a little bit more specifically, Bobby.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Chair Roland and members of the committee, thank you for the time to present before you today. The following the same pattern that Mike was going with, Lane County suffered 28.5% loss in our general fund, and in the road fund is well over 50%. In actuality, it's 52.8%. To give you an idea of what we did in Lane County, to try to help ourselves, is that we partnered with the City of Eugene around the road funds. The City of Eugene had some reserve dollars in their maintenance reserves to provide repair and surfacing for their roads. We did have a reserve in our road fund dollars. The City of Eugene graciously gave us $4.5 million out of their reserves to use to restore services in Lane County, the ones that were being eliminated or slated for closure or reductions. Also, the City of Springfield offered up, and we accepted, $250,000 from their general fund to help us provide services that were very critical to children, women and children and families, also monies for animal control, if you will. Now, as you know, may not know, Lane County is a general purpose government, which means that we provide a huge list array of services. But the most glaring impact that the citizens will see and have seen is in the public safety arena. You know, in 1995, Senate Bill 1145 was passed that ordered us to provide a public safety system. And for over a decade, we have done that. But given the loss of these timber dollars, we have not been able to sustain that effort. For example, we notified 59 county employees that they will no longer be employed by Lane County, and we have an additional 120 open positions that we're not going to fill, mainly due to the fact of recruitment and retention. We're not able to recruit the best and the brightest, if you will, because we're not certain of our future, whether we can retain them. So that's another issue that we're dealing with. Also, in our local jails, there's about 507 beds in the jail, and 107 of them are closed due to the insufficient funding. And also in the district attorney's office, he predicted that 500 felony drug and property crimes will not be prosecuted because of the loss of one assistant DA and zero staff support. In our forest work camp, where we could hold the local offenders accountable, is closed now, and that was 100 beds. And that was something that the citizens had voted for years ago, and at this point in time, we cannot continue to sustain that. An average of over 1,000 offenders who provide more than 50,000 hours of each community service at the local agencies in different areas will no longer be there. And that's going to hurt our road crew, particularly around vegetation management, if you will, because we're using those road crews to keep that type of work going on. But also will be eliminated or reduced is the extension services. OSU extension service, they lost 4 to 5.5 FTEs this budget session here. And we're into our reserve period right now. We also dug into the reserves so that the sheriff can provide 5 more rural deputies on patrol, as well as the 24-hour 911 operation. Can you imagine someone calling 911 and there's no one there to answer? Not a good thing to have in any county, let alone Lane County, which is one of the 4 largest counties in the state. To show you how difficult it is to sustain the system has actually been degraded, zero down. There was a case in Lane County just recently, you may have heard about it, it was a Justin Mooch De Loreto conviction, some motorcycle gang member. You have the article there. He actually was acquitted on a number of different felonies, and then he was convicted on misdemeanors. And once he was sentenced, the DA actually knew that he would be one of the people let go and released into the community, and it's happening all the time. He's scheduled to do 21 days on the road crew. He lives about 45 minutes away. If he doesn't show up, well, we may not have staff to go get him. Because even if we do, he's going to be released again into the community. And that's what people will be facing, and that's what they are facing right now at the local level. We see it all the time, and it's not a good feeling. It's almost like an open door for crime. As I've said before, with the loss of these timber dollars, the only people that seems to be happy about it are the convicted offenders, the felonies. They're the ones happy that we're not getting the money because they know we're not being able to hold them accountable. So, again, we've asked the state to help us build a bridge, not a bailout. No, it's not. There's no way any one agency can do that. It's going to take a partnership and a whole effort by everyone to make this system get back to where it needs to be.
Thank you. We started by comparing the experience the counties are facing with what the state went through in 2001-03. And I want to point out that the state cut its budget then, obviously, so have the counties. The state made some good decisions in terms of economic development. The counties are struggling to do the same with fewer resources. But more importantly, I think the state benefited because of its tax system from the rebound in the economy. And in fact, we rode that economic rebound, the wave of that economic rebound, to fiscal health. That's not something the counties can do, even if they, even if we are lucky enough to have an economic rebound in the short term. It's because of their tax system. And in our report, we call attention to some examples. On page 31, the example in 1995 where an industrial manufacturer named Alcan Cable, located in Douglas County, and brought 200, and ended up, business activity there resulted in 200 new homes for housing their employees. Come all the way up to 2008. The property taxes from that business and the homes combined results in $63,000 a year in county taxes in Douglas County, which is less than the cost of one deputy sheriff. Commissioner Mark Labhart from Tillamook pointed out that there are 154 new homes being built along the oceanside in his county. Those 154 new homes will generate a grand total of $34,000 a year in new property tax revenues for the county. So given the structure of the local tax system, counties do not have the luxury of banking on economic development to provide the revenues in terms of economic, the revenues from economic activity that can eventually get them back to solvency. So that's an important consideration to keep in mind as we talk now about the solutions we examined for solving these problems. And we looked at those solutions in four categories. One is what can the counties and county taxpayers do to help themselves? That's the first resort. Secondly, what can the state and state taxpayers do to help the counties? Thirdly, what can we expect from federal sources, namely other forms of revenue sharing that can help? We identified a number of those. And finally, and most significantly, but somewhat out there in the future, is the potential for better management of federal forest lands to ensure healthy forests and sustainable harvests. And with higher harvest levels, sustainable, we then can look at what amount of new harvest receipts might be forthcoming and available to the counties to help help solve this problem. But the first inquiry was, what can the counties and county taxpayers do to help themselves? We looked at the existing tax capacity under Measure 5 and Measure 50 And this is somewhat misleading because this is on paper, and there are different taxing districts and tax code areas in any given county. Whether you're inside or outside of a city, obviously has a big impact on whether you're paying close to the $10 maximum local government rate under Measure 5. But still, rough numbers, big picture, statewide. There's a lot of potential unused in the local government tax rate and the county tax rate as part of that. And so you see here how the counties line up in their use of that tax capacity, so to speak. I think maybe Mike wants to add a disclaimer here.
Yeah, this is because of Measure 50, this is very complicated, and the calculation has to be done on a code-by-code, or actually property-by-property basis, and you don't really know what's available until you've run the roll with the new figures in it. But as an example, take Coos County, which shows a use of 30% of their capacity, and I know that the county's rate is low, $1.20, I recall, but the city of Coos Bay has $6.60, so there's $8.80 of the $10 just between those two entities. I'm sure there are other taxing districts. So most of the value's in cities that have their own tax rates. So, you know, if you're only getting the value from the unincorporated area, then you may not get as much as this forecast. So just a caveat that, you know, there may be 45% or so, 55% available, but it's something that's very, very difficult to determine right away.
And what you're saying there, if they were to graze it, the compression would happen with those in the city, and they'd have to share that. They wouldn't get the same amount from each of the people.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
But theoretically, that's what the numbers
space.
Show. And then there's a practical challenge. Maybe we should look at the next two slides, Mike. By the way, those are how the county's tax rates line up. And the darker bars indicate counties that have local option taxes. Although that might be a year old. I know just Deschutes now has one, so we may have to update that for you. It's accurate in the full report. And then finally, to get an idea of the relative tax effort at the county level, the next chart shows the percent of per capita personal income paid by county residents in the form of property taxes. Now, I do want to remind you that Measure 50 froze the rates in effect in around about 1996 or the 2 years prior, and those became the permanent rates for the counties. They cannot be changed. We would take a constitutional amendment to change those permanent rates. They can be supplemented with local option taxes, which is why in our inquiry the task force paid a lot of attention to what's the existing tax capacity and what under Measure 50 can be done via local option taxes approved by the voters to supplement those county tax rates. But before we go too far in blaming these counties for having a low tax rate, we have to recognize that they were recipients of the harvest revenues in the 90s. And when Measure 50 took effect, it froze their tax rates at those levels. Now, in order to raise them, they have to go to the voters for temporary local option taxes. And in fact, 10 counties statewide have done that. It's easy to look at the first chart and say some of these counties can double or triple their tax rates, and that will help solve the problem. But in fact, in Josephine County, it would take a quadrupling. In Douglas County, it would take a tripling. And I don't think anybody reasonably expects voters in any jurisdiction in the state, nor can you point to any instance when voters in any jurisdiction in the state have voted to double or triple or quadruple their taxes, nor could a local economy be expected to absorb the shock of that all at once. So we looked for a more moderate approach. And on the principle that the task force unanimously supported counties using the tax capacity they have now and using the local option as a mechanism to increase their tax effort. We looked at the average of those 10 counties which have local option taxes in effect, approved by their voters, and looked at the magnitude of the increase of those on average. And they averaged close to 20%, depending on whether you do an average or a median. I think it's 13 or 18% above their permanent rate. And we felt that if these 10 counties and their voters approved tax, the local option tax increases of that magnitude, it would be at least reasonable to expect that as the initial response available to the counties which haven't enacted local option taxes. Remember, these counties have already cut their budgets, or they're cutting them quite severely. We're talking about what to do after you get to that bare bones level. And the first option then for these counties is to look at what they can do by going to their own voters and enacting local option taxes. And you see here what those 10, 20, and 30% increases in a county rate, which would compute to 2, 3, or 5% increases in a total tax rate paid by a taxpayer. What the amount of revenue we would see in the 24 hard-hit counties. Now, the 24 hard-hit counties are going to experience revenue losses in their general funds and road funds of $179 million next year. And we took that larger number, that $206 million, and we looked at the loss for the hard-hit counties, and that's $179 million. So we use those as the benchmark counties against which to compare the various solutions. How much of the problem or how much of the gap? How much of the problem could we solve? How much of the gap could we fill with these approaches? And so the first one shows you here in the pie chart. Again, the large blue circle is at $179 million. Depending on whether county voters in these 24 counties would approve 10, 20, or 30% increases via local option tax increases, it would solve somewhere between 8 and 25% of that $179 million shortfall. So a first step, but really a very, very, very much a partial solution.
And those local options are for a set period of time, and they'd have
5 years for our
5 years, and then
maximum.
They have to be reauthorized,
right,
or they'd go back to the same problem.
We also looked at other revenue constraints the counties have and how they might be freed from them to enact other forms of taxes. We did not have unanimity on those recommendations, and in fact we'll be discussing those with the Revenue Task Force next week. But it's pretty clear that where we did have consensus and unanimity on the task force was looking at the county level, what can be done with this within the existing system, and using as a benchmark what other counties have already done, who have enacted local option taxes above their permanent rates.
The one thing though that your previous slide showed was that per capita, many of these also have lower incomes for their county residents to pay that taxes with. I mean, that's a flatter graph except for Sherman and Gilliam.
Sherman and Gilliam have high rates.
Or whatever, based on whatever rate they are. But when you look at the others, where it looked a lot higher in a different rate, it evens it out when you look at its rate in comparison
to
their capacity to pay. Okay.
This is where the next inquiry was, how can the state and state taxpayers help the counties? And this is where we spent most of our time, as the representative and senator know from your work on the task force. We scoured the state budget. We looked at every program area. We focused particularly on the areas where there's the partnership, the shared services between the state and the counties, shared in terms of financing and shared in terms of service delivery. Particular focus on public safety and public health, and also on a variety of areas that we ended up categorizing as related to economic development. So the OSU Extension Services, for instance, services provided by the Water Resources Department and County Water Masters. All those fit with economic development. And we ended up with 27 recommendations for improving the partnership or assisting the counties in the delivery of services. Six in the economic development area. Another recommendation for creation of an emergency fund for counties, just as we have an emergency fund for state agencies. And finally, another look at some of the other areas where the state controls the revenue. For instance, it's by state law that we enact property tax exemptions or in other ways control the property tax system. I want to point out that I think we accomplished a lot here, and even if we end up getting a reauthorization, as we much hope for, we've identified areas where we can improve the partnership and where I think both short-term and long-term we should work on those improvements. Mike, do you want to add anything to that?
Like you say, I think this is a tremendous documentation of the relationship that exists between state and counties. And even without the loss of federal forest payments, counties, because of the systematic handcuffs that they find themselves in with regards to revenue, were experiencing financial difficulty sooner or later across the state. So these are items that have been identified that I think are worthy of our attention no matter what happens.
And in the separate handout we gave you with a one page on the impacts and the additional eight pages on the recommendations, we list for you word for word all 54 recommendations. We note which ones had any dissenting votes. And just to give you a flavor for some of them, when it comes to courts and DAs, obviously we've had higher funding levels from the state to the counties to support prosecution. We identified prior studies which recommended as much as $20 million a biennium more from the state. We ended up at the $5 million level. We very much functioned like a Ways and Means Committee. We were tough on ourselves and tough on the proposals, and some of them got whittled down, but we feel that each and every one of these is the kind of proposal we could bring to the Ways and Means Committee and justify, even in the absence of the crisis we're facing.
Tim, if I may, yes. Just to reflect on the fact that over nearly half the problem is on the transportation or roadside. And as you know, we're facing a general problem with transportation finance in Oregon, and attention to the transportation package or working on the road funding issue is something that's very much at the front of our interests going forward, trying to grow the pot.
Other examples, the medical examiner, you heard about that in an earlier committee meeting this year. The state police provides medical examiner services in most of the counties in Oregon, but not in the southern Oregon counties. And there's an enhancement in eastern Oregon that will work as well. Not a big ticket item, but something that will help those counties. Community corrections. At a minimum, we want to make sure that we don't let the funding formula that exists now compound the problem if counties end up with fewer prosecutions and fewer inmates in their jails. We don't want to see that, at least for the short term, lead to a reduction in state funding, which is keyed to the jail populations that they maintain. Public health, I thought we did some good work in identifying how currently with the state funding keyed to a per capita allotment to the counties, you reach a point where at some point in a low population county you're not getting enough money to maintain the semblance of a public health department. And so we're creating a baseline there, and we worked with DHS to identify a dollar amount, and they're still working on fine-tuning how the formula will work. They're working with the Conference of Local Health Officials on that one. Addictions and mental health, veteran services, again, that's a matter of not cutting the funding that the state provides when county can't maintain its effort in the coming years. Assessment and taxation, I want to compliment the representatives of the schools and the special districts in the cities who worked on this, because they've agreed to see redirected the delinquent interest, which now flows to schools and cities as well as counties, and to have that go to the CAFA account where it can be applied 100% to the counties. Those are in every county general fund dollars which are fungible and which could otherwise be freed up for compelling needs such as public safety and public health. So with the understanding that the state would be backfilling what the schools give up, we think that's a pretty important and significant recommendation. And the roads, as Mike said, offer particular challenges because the source of funding at the local level for roads is quite constrained. And a lot here has to do with redistributing monies that first with a different kind of baseline for the small counties, a $4,500 per road minimum, or in the case of how we distribute those, what will remain of the harvest receipts from the Forest Service lands, instead of 75% roads and 25% schools. If in fact the secure rural schools payments are not reauthorized, we're recommending that the state, which controls this formula, change that distribution so it's 100% county roads, and the state then, through its general fund, can pick up and augment the loss that the schools would otherwise entail, since it's flowing to all school districts anyway. Again, I want to thank the representatives of the school districts and the OEA for meeting us halfway on that one. Economic development, I think the most significant recommendation here would be the creation of a fund for targeted investments. This recommendation number 37. Mike, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, there are opportunities in rural Oregon for economic development. It generally takes capacity, and we're lacking sorely in that capacity, and the counties are losing their ability to go after, pursue opportunities, for instance, in renewable energy, where there's considerable opportunity in rural Oregon right now. It takes some local effort to be able to try and line up projects, pursuing other sources of federal funding for economic development opportunities takes capacity. And so finding a way to replace the capacity that's necessary in rural Oregon is one of our recommendations.
And then also I mentioned I mentioned the idea of an emergency fund for the counties. If it were set at 1% of the estimated state general funds that flow to the counties, that will flow to the counties in the next biennium, it would come in at about a five million dollar amount there. And this relates as well to a later recommendation we have for the creation of, for the authorization of financial control boards where counties are facing insolvency. And finally, a couple of items related to the state's control of revenue streams that flow to the counties. First two having to do with the property tax, where we agreed unanimously that that fund to reimburse counties for new property tax expenditures under certain circumstances should be properly funded by the legislature, and that we should also look as well at some of the property tax breaks that were enacted prior to that fund, which have a particular impact on the rural counties, which exempt from property taxation recreational facilities and summer homes and mining claims on federal land. And then finally, a recommendation where we had two dissenters, both Senator Girard and Senator Bates, on raising the recording fee. Part of the concern there was that there have been proposals in prior sessions about raising this fee and using it for affordable housing. So there's a lot of competition over this idea. But nonetheless, it does support that assessment and taxation funding we talked about earlier, and could provide more general fund support for the counties. Now, if we add up all of these ideas, and again, these are what we spent most of our time on, and in the report you see there's a dollar amount identified for each and every one of these recommendations, we end up with, in that yellow slice there, low end to high end, solving somewhere between 3% and 15% of that $179 million shortfall for the hard hit counties. Again, it's a contribution. It's a step in the right direction. I think the merits of these proposals are what they are, and they would deserve consideration even in a less critical time. But given all the other demands on the state budget, we haven't yet figured out a way to provide health care for all children in Oregon, for instance, and there'll be a struggle over that in the next session, and many other demands in terms of school funding. I'm not sure we could ever get to that 15% number in a single biennium, but we lay it out there because, each of these proposals has its merits, case to be made, and we might want to look at that as a longer-term two-biennium target. Next, ways in which the federal government can provide a better share of the revenues it controls. Some of these could be done in the near term. For instance, the O&C counties, which receive 50% of the harvest receipts from O&C lands, the BLM managed lands, the underlying O&C legislation in its current form as I think last drafted in 1937, if I remember correctly, provides for a 75% share for the counties after the counties had paid off and devoted 25% of the revenues to pay off the cost of reacquiring those lands. By the 1950s, that had been done, and I think in 1953 or thereabouts, the 75% formula took effect, but soon thereafter, and every year thereafter, Congress has, in its budget bills, overridden the 75% share in the Department of Interior budget and said the counties shall live with a 50% share. And that's been the case ever since. Now, Congressman DeFazio has, I'm not sure if it's a piece of legislation or a appropriations rider that would, for the budget being worked on in the Congress currently, by not overriding the 50%, we would default to the 75%, and that's what DeFazio's approach would accomplish. So this is something which is certainly feasible, and you'll see in a moment from Marvin Brown, we are expecting to see higher harvest levels from the ONC lands, both short-term and mid-term. And so a higher share of those would have a significant impact and definitely be helpful to the counties. We're also calling attention to the fact that, as you may have read, you know, when these economic stimulus checks were issued by the feds this month, and when tax refunds are issued by the IRS, if you owe child support, you can very well see that amount diverted to pay off your child support debt. If we had the same process in place for court fines and fees and restitution to victims unpaid by the recipient, we could see a significant amount of revenue flow to the states and the cities and the counties around the country by setting up that. It would be secondary to the child support claim, but the estimate from the Oregon Judicial Department is there's $57 million of biennium available there. And the counties would get it shared by formula, so would the cities, so would the state. So when you add up all of these ideas, we go back to that pie chart before we get to the harvest projections. Best case scenario, maximizing the efforts identified in all of these areas in the proposals, we could be solving about half the problem. The remainder of the problem we look at in terms of this asset, this resource of our federal forest lands, and what can be done to make for healthier forests, more sustainable harvests from those forests, and in effect getting more economic value back into these counties from that asset. And with that, we have a little bit of a moving target here about how much of these harvest receipts can we count on seeing in the next couple of years. You remember that very first bar graph you saw with that little red sliver? In fact, we may see some bump up in that projection, a modest one, but still one we don't want to get wrong in terms of the revenues that may be coming to the counties. And I'll let Marvin Brown walk you through the latest information we have from the BLM and the Forest Service and what we might see from those lands.
Thanks, Chairman Oberlin, members of the committee. I'm Marvin Brown, state forester. I was a member of the task force, and with Commissioner Smith from Jackson County, we co-chaired a group to look at federal forest practices and what you might realistically expect to have those contribute more revenue over the long term. Everybody knows that the reason the Secure Rural Schools Act came into being was because federal timber harvests were greatly reduced. At their peak, they were about 5 billion board feet in 1 year. Since the early 90s, they've very rarely exceeded about 300 million board feet. And just if you start looking at some of the figures, where they've been, say, from 2001 to 2006, the receipts from that would make up about 7% of the amount of money that's currently coming from the Secure Rural Schools Act. In recent years, federal government has tried to improve their record, their harvesting amount, and actually the 2007 harvest level would make up about 10% of the loss of the revenues that traditionally came from the act. And if you look at their 2008 projections, you could go all the way up to about 16% if they were in fact to achieve their 2008 harvest targets. That compares to the Northwest Forest Plan, which was installed in 1994 as an answer to listing of the Northern Spotted Owl. The total harvestable quantities that were projected in the Northwest Forest Plan were about 1 billion board feet a year. And if 1 billion board feet were implemented, you would get to about 30% of the revenue that currently comes from the Act. That's one way to look at that, if you could just simply implement current plans as they are. The other scenario that we looked at, though, was kind of projecting the current discussions around BLM's revision of their ONC lands plan, adding some rough estimates of what that might yield in the future to what the Forest Service is projecting as some of their, you know, most recent annual projections, and that gets you to about the same level of about a billion board feet a year if you add those two figures together. And again, that is just a very approximate guess of what BLM might end up proposing in their plan, plus what the Forest Service currently proposes as their annual target. So those are the figures that we looked at. Again, in total, they might end up replacing about 30% of the total funds that currently come under the Secure Rural Schools Act.
So I think we have another slide to look
there
at there with the
numbers.
There is
one more slide. It just breaks down the numbers more specifically. And it's important to know that they're distributed differently based on whether it's Forest Service land or BLM land. And obviously, they're distributed to different counties based on where the land resides.
And if I could, when we did the projection for the loss of revenue going forward and talked about that $179 million for the 24 hard-hit counties, that was assuming a level of residual harvest receipts at about 10%. We see that 2007 harvest number. And so to go from 10% to 30% means, and we already assumed that before we netted out to $179 million. So the 10% is after the receipt. I mean, the $179 million is after the receipt of that amount. So by going to 30%, we would be solving an additional 20% of that shortfall, and which I think we show on the last slide there, if you can click through, Marvin. One more there.
One more?
Yeah. Okay, so there we go, finishing that pie chart, starting with $179 million for the 24 hard-hit counties. And we still then have a pretty big range. You know, we best-case scenarios, getting everything done in every category, and not all of which is under our control because we'll need some legislation at the federal level. And getting to the harvest levels Marvin projected, which are probably not achievable until, 2012?
Yeah, it'd be at least 4 years.
2012. We see we could recover as much as 75% of the lost revenue, some of it with tax effort, some of it with state support, some of it with shares of federal revenue, and some of it with harvest receipts. But at least that is manageable. Short of that, our conclusion was we cannot successfully manage our way out of this crisis in the short term. Obviously, there's no one solution. We'll need to patch together solutions involving counties, the state, and the federal government, and the harvest practices that are decided by the federal government. The state can have a role in that. We have a lot of other recommendations in our report, one of which is that if the Western Oregon Plan Revision does not provide timely results as hoped, that the state should consider taking over. Of course, the federal government would have to agree to this, but the state should offer to take over the management of ONC lands. Those lands would remain under the protection of the National Environmental Protection Act, but we think the state's record on the Elliott Forest and others under the state management plan indicate that we can do a better job of getting these forests to healthy conditions and providing a more sustainable harvest yield. Finally, we concluded that we found that Oregon, unlike many states, does not have any mechanism in statute for dealing with bankruptcies at the local level or fiscal distress short of bankruptcy. We considered but did not recommend enabling local governments to use Chapter 9 bankruptcy under the Internal Revenue Code, because that would have the effect of raising borrowing costs for local governments around the state. But we did unanimously agree that the state should adopt by statute mechanisms that would allow for oversight and supervision if counties simply get to the point of insolvency and basically are saying we can't manage anymore with the amount of revenue we have. That would involve the creation of financial control boards, and those boards could eventually take over the functions of the county until the county was back on its feet financially. So that is the final recommendation. But going back to the very first recommendation, we need a reauthorization of at least 4 years to be able to manage our way out of this problem and to do so with any hope of a successful outcome. So we reiterate that. We haven't given up yet. We've had a big disappointment this month with the failure of the Congress to include funding here in the Iraq War supplemental, which is kind of a misnomer since it included $100 billion of domestic spending. We were not part of that. There'll be efforts made when Congress gets back together this summer not ones this summer that we have high hopes for, but in the fall, if there's an omnibus budget bill, that'll be our next opportunity. And even come January with a new Congress and a new administration, it won't be too late because we'll still be dealing with the funding for the 08-09 year. That's plan C, if you will. We'll be continuing the effort. But I think it's going to be important for all of us now that we've looked at the impacts and looked at all the potential solutions to commit to working with our delegation and the new administration. When either candidate comes to Oregon, we should be reminding them of this, that we need this reauthorization, that the reason our counties are so heavily affected by this is because they were the most productive timberlands in the country, which is why we get the largest share of these payments. And yes, we can find a way to manage out of this. It will take 4 years. The state should adopt a four-year plan if we get a four-year reauthorization. If we don't, or if it's 1 year, we should be ready to enact some of the more stringent responses we've identified in our report. But either way, it's going to take time. It's going to take hopefully the cooperation of the feds and the decisions we're asking them to make around revenue sharing, around harvest practices, and around the reauthorization of the Secure Rural Schools Act.
Questions? Senator.
No, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to point out one thing that kind of fell under Marvin's domain that I really, really liked, and that was the fact that the committee came through with support of the Whopper, and the fact that if we fail with the Whopper, we might look at managing the ONC lands ourselves, and that it was across the board, it was pretty unanimous that we needed to cut more timber and that it was environmentally friendly to do so. One thing I was going to ask, a couple questions. One is, Tim, I know you kept saying we're holding out hope. The last, what do you think the possibility is of getting this extension? Because I'm hoping you know something I don't.
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, I don't want to handicap it, but we're not going to give up. And I actually think in the next Congress and with the next administration, if we continue to point out the impacts and show that we have a plan to get through this in 4 years, and we're willing to say the next reauthorization can be a phased down one. We can manage it that way over 4 years. It doesn't necessarily phase down to zero, but phases down. And if we can get the higher harvest shares, it could perhaps be replaced completely by that system. But that we do have a plan to get there, and we're not just asking for a 4 year bailout, after which we'll be asking for another one. It is that bridge that Bobby Green referred to. That's what we need.
One follow-up, and one other comment is, I got to tell you, I really enjoyed the committee. I learned an awful lot, and there's a lot of diversity on that committee, and we seem to come to we agreed on 99% of the stuff, yeah. Probably. It's pretty interesting. But, Mike, this one's for you. And Bobby did a great job talking about Lane County and the problems. The two counties that are going to go critical first are Curry and Josephine. Could you tell the audience here kind of what the staffing level is for public safety in those counties right now? Give them an idea of what we're talking. I mean, this is how much they're funded now, just in trying to hold things off here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, interesting to bring that up. There was a feature article in the Oregonian the other day about particularly the case in Josephine County where the rural bar tender is a proprietor of an establishment in rural Josephine County was demonstrating her Derringer that she keeps with her behind the bar, and how the last time they called the sheriff, it took him a week and a half to come, and that his advice was don't shoot anybody in the back. the practical matter of Josephine County, which is in my estimation closest to the line, I think John Krosick would agree with that, is that they're at an unsustainable level of service right now. They're only, for 80,000 people, they only collect $3.5 million in property taxes, and given other basic functions that are required, like the assessment and taxation function, there's just no money left for anything discretionary. They can keep felons with the 1145 funding, state community corrections funding, but they won't be able to afford rural patrol. And there's been some talk there about various
options that they might take. I think the recognition is that it's becoming bad for their economy to have public safety in such a condition. But I think, as Commissioner Green would tell you, you really need that realization to help. That there's help needed to come from the people. People need to realize that and see that they would be better off if they had a higher level of service. And I think Commissioner Griffith said it once well in Coos County, the people will get about as much government as they're willing to pay for. And that's the situation. So the discretionary activities of counties, which are primarily in law enforcement and public health, will be eliminated except for those other funding streams that come in, like the state grants that come for public health. You'll be able to maintain those programs, but anything discretionary won't be there.
And I know that we heard at that same discussion that Curry had gone to 5 patrol officers.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Curry started the ramp down last year, and so they won't be facing quite the cliff that Josephine is, but Curry is already at a very low level of service and can only sustain that through June of 2009.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the work that you did. I could barely sit through half of one of your meetings. It's really depressing. And I'm with Representative Callan, and so I appreciate you bring in the perspectives of the counties and of the governor to bear, and the Forest Service to bear on this. But, you know, I would disagree with the wording on one of the reports here that says it will create, you know, we are in crisis. So I guess one of my questions is, particularly for you, Mr. Nesbitt, is, you know, what is a bigger crisis for our state? What is a bigger issue for the formulation of a budget than this one?
I guess that's a ways and means question. Representative, I would say that we know we have major challenges. We have imperatives. We've got crises. In the first category, I'd put finding a way to make sure all kids have health care in the state. That's a priority of the governors. And we continue to be challenged to improve our education system. You know, the irony with that loss of $58 per student here from the loss of the Securable Schools payments is that we probably bumped down at or below the national average for funding. We had just managed to get above the national average. I don't have the final numbers yet. I think they're still being crunched. We need to continue to make progress with school funding, with the affordability of higher education. And now we have an added challenge. I cannot rank them for you, one versus the other. All I can tell you is that the governor is going to be looking at this, and looking at the recommendations of our report. There's no one solution. The state can't do it by itself. We need at the county level our citizens working together with us. Statewide, we need to be fashioning solutions. We need to be looking to solutions at the federal level, and we can't manage our way through this by focusing on any one solution.
Thank you for that. Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
And Mr. Chair, I recognize that this is the Rural Policy Committee and not the Health Care Committee. Let's just remember he brought this up. And I would submit to you that you brought it up twice. That, of course, I'm one of those people that doesn't care about kids. And I voted against that. And I was really, really surprised that the governor said that was his priority for this next budget, for this next session. And I'll give him the benefit of the doubt because you didn't hand him this report before he said that. But I would submit that if you want to see kids in trouble, far more important than the debate over how many are or are not already covered under current state plans, look for what happens to families if we don't find funding for this, if we don't do the kind of things that you all are recommending, if we don't get the congressional delegation to come through and stop the infighting and convince people in Washington that this is not the same apples. It's apples and oranges to, you know, subsidies to agriculture communities. That this is a deal that the federal government is leaving us hanging out to dry on. I just can't think of a bigger priority for the governor and for this delegation than this one, which is one of the reasons I was very happy to be put on this committee, because I think this is our crisis. I think this is our special session. And I just, when I can, want to communicate that as directly as we can to the governor. I don't think there's anything more important.
If I may, Mr. Chair and Representative, if you look at our recommendations in the areas of public health and addiction and mental health and so on, there are also a number of areas where we call out statements of support for expanding the Oregon Health Plan, which will relieve the counties of a lot of the costs they're now bearing, too, for families in crisis. So it's all interconnected, and I know the governor is well aware of that and was impressed with the severity of this problem. And also with the fact that, as I said, it's going to take multiple solutions from multiple sources in order to resolve it.
Representative Cowan.
I don't think that there's any doubt that my passion is with the delivery of services at the county level, and we all know that's where I come from. But one of the very difficult questions to answer when I'm out there talking to people in general, as you describe impacts on counties or the way counties deliver services or the differences from county to county, there's a significant difference in the way our counties function across the state. Did the task force look at all, or can you speak to how to answer that question, I guess, of fairness in this, when you see such a diversity of property tax rates and the way services are delivered and the use of timber dollars in one county compared to another? I'm the most familiar with Lincoln County. I know that those monies have gone into our road department for a long time. That's where it's been focused, and that's why there's much less hit on the county general fund discretionary dollars as compared to another county. Was there any look at how you address this question of what's the right structure? Would some consolidation of services, i.e. combining some counties, be beneficial? How did the task force look at addressing that fairness question from one taxpayer to the next across the state?
Well, it always comes up, and it came up right at the beginning of our inquiry about equity of tax effort from county to county. And as you see, we addressed it by trying to be realistic, understanding how some counties are locked into the low tax rates that they had in the mid-90s. And what might reasonably be expected of county taxpayers, again, taking our cues from counties where the voters have approved local option tax increases. So I think the recommendation we gave you in that area is the most considered and reasonable and most considered one we could give you that's attached to a reasonable expectation of. It's one thing to say all counties should be paying at least the same. But you often hear that. And so we kind of challenge that assumption. Sure. And rather than assuming that all counties should be at some minimum level of tax rates and tax effort, we said it's much more practical to look at where counties are now and ask that those who haven't yet gone to their voters for local option taxes start taking those steps. So if they all took one or two steps ahead, even if they start from different places, that would certainly be a measure of tax effort, which I think then would be quite significant. But as you can tell from the commentary in the Oregonian story on Sunday, a lot of voters don't yet believe it. They haven't yet perceived the impact of the loss of funding as a loss of services that they care about. That's still playing out in those counties. It's going to take leadership, I believe, from a lot more than the elected county commissioners and county officials. It's going to take the business community and community leaders, as I think was modeled well in Benton County with a measure that the local option tax that went to the voters there, where it was led by that kind of a coalition. So that's the community response that we hope to see, if there are ways in which we can encourage it by just pointing out the differences and the impact of the funding losses. I think the state can play a role, a leadership role in that, an assisting role in that. I think the leadership has to come from the local level.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, you know well, having sat through county budget committee sessions, that there's a lot of momentum. Each county has a way of doing things, certain priorities that each county sets. I think there's a certain respect for the local choice, local autonomy, decisions made locally that we have to respect. And I think that the way that this report's been laid out, the strategy that Mr. Nesbitt's detailed here of multiple sources of fixes, if you will, to get us out of a problem it took us a long time to get into, we have to look at different ways to go about that. And perhaps each county needs to examine itself in comparison to other counties and say, and look at other counties and how they managed to deal with the same services. And are there more efficient models? Is regionalization an opportunity? I think that's something that counties need to take up, and that's something our association is positioned to help them do.
I would add one other thing. When we showed you the data on dollars per capita that could be expected to finance a county at a bare bones level, that was kind of a new set of data, and I want to compliment John Krosick from Yamhill County who came up with that, because we did need some kind of objective standard to apply to all the counties and say, you know, you can either make it or not make it with this amount of revenue, and we did accomplish that with that analysis.
Can I follow up here just recently?
Yeah, please.
I understand that I didn't want to make it sound like I hadn't been listening and hadn't heard what you said. I think it's something that we need to kind of continually focus on, because in its most simple format, it's difficult for people to grasp some of these issues and some of the economic situations in various counties that make it a limited number of taxpayers with really challenged economies very difficult to make it up on property tax. But I guess I'm looking, as we try to figure out if we have to deal with Recommendation 54 in terms of legislation, to try to figure out how to deal with counties that, I mean, we haven't really addressed what to do with a county that goes bankrupt. We don't have that methodology. And so I guess that's beyond regionalization. I'm wondering if we're a part of that review is looking at you know, scrunching three into one or something. You know, I just got back from Kentucky not too long ago, where they have 105 counties, and so they, for their perspective, 36 seemed like a real reasonable number. But did we look at any economies of scale with that thought in mind?
In the report, the recommendations in the area of community corrections and the youth authority both address the regionalization of state planning and coordination at the local level. So we looked at that. We also looked at that very question of what if two counties need to merge. Actually, under Measure 50, under our Constitution, you then take the weighted average tax rate of that one county and the weighted average tax rate of the other county, and you do a weighted average of the two, and so there are no new dollars there. So if you have a county in trouble at their tax rates, merger doesn't necessarily solve any problems. It might just spread the problem to another county.
I appreciate you bringing that out. The wonderful structure that we're working with now makes this very easy to deal with.
Yes,
Chair Roblin, if I may add, there is a model, not so much with counties merging with each other, excuse me, but there are opportunities that I'm well aware of where counties and cities can actually share services. The most current one that I'm aware of, and there's others as well, is in the city of Charlotte, North Carolina, with the county of Mecklenburg. And it was a little, it was easier for them to do it because the county, was smaller than the city. And it was in the, public service, I mean, the public safety arena, where the county actually just did the jail. Service to provide the jail, and then the cities actually did the patrol. Now maybe something similar can happen here as well, where where one county is considering eliminating their rural patrol, where then maybe they can partner with another county. There are opportunities out there to do that. It just takes a willingness, and then getting the people involved at the community level. Tim referenced the model in Benton County, where it took a coalition to say that this is the kind of county we want, this is what we're willing to do to work for it. And I'm also going to say that when we talk about the degradation of a system, it's not just the public safety system, it is the entire system in the community, because if we're unable to provide meaningful jobs and stability for the family, guess what? Somebody has to lose a job. Someone's losing a job. Just recently, we lost so many deputies that Multnomah County actually came down and did an open recruitment for our deputies, just those deputies that were in facing losing their jobs. Also, that means that those families have to move, and in times of uncertainty, that means that the kids not quite sure what school the parents are going to send them to. And then keep in mind, too, these are working families who have never had to access our social service system. They're not real well versed on the bureaucracy. They're people who are working day to day and just lost their job. In most cases, both mom and dad lost the job. So we're talking about a system that is really going to take years to get back to that level. And that's what we've been asking for those 4 years. And I know you, all of you, have been advocates for that reauthorization. You're just going to have to re-up and go back at it again.
Okay. Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. Tim kind of brought up what I was going to say, and that I shared Representative Cowan's belief that maybe Jackson County could take over Josephine County.
No, wait, it wasn't my belief. Laying out the question.
No, I'm just laying out the question. But I thought amalgamation was one of our solutions that we had to be viably looking at, and apparently ballot measure 50 puts a crank in that. But I still got people looking at the fine language. I'm not 100% convinced of that, but I think that's probably true.
Representative Gillum. Gillum.
Thank you. Really say Gillum County. I understand. I want to ask a question about the sustainable solutions for federal forest lands portion, and maybe the state forester could respond to this. I'm looking at the this document that has the recommendations. To me, you know, there's a fine line between planning for what may be inevitable and punting. And I am no expert. Everybody on this panel would agree. I am no expert on forest policy. In my district, we cut Christmas trees freely. So as I look at these recommendations, they don't appear to me to be overly aggressive. You may have had all kinds of pushback and all kinds of discussions that I'm not aware of. But do these look aggressive to you? And the reason I ask the question is obviously desperate times. We need to do some pretty bold things. And it's oversimplifying the argument to some, but not to me. You're not going to let us either cut our trees or be compensated for it. I don't understand that. And I think we need aggressive pushback to utilize wisely, with stewardship, our resource.
Chair Roblin and Representative Gilliam, it's a fair question when you look at the scale of things that have gone on in the past when the federal lands peaked at 5 billion board feet and now they're more like 300 or 400 million. But times have changed since the 5 billion board feet. And I think realistically, you can't expect to turn back the clock to that level because, in fact, when federal lands were harvesting at that level, they weren't doing everything they needed to do to protect water quality They weren't protecting endangered species, and they weren't doing, you know, several things that society pretty well demands right now. But there is room for a lot more improvement than what's going on currently. And actually, what we found as we held a couple of three meetings and invited a variety of folks in to talk to us, we found some reason to be optimistic that both the timber community and the environmental community are coming to agreement on some issues that we think will in the end help get the level back up to maybe in this billion board feet a year range. The forest health concerns, so you were talking about that with the last panel, are realizations that everybody has now, and they're agreeing that it's going to take thinning and some harvesting and some better management to deal with those issues. And there's been some pretty good examples in eastern Oregon and southern Oregon and other places where those traditionally arguing factions have come together and agreed, yeah, we need to do some thinning to improve forest health. And that's really what our kind of realistic presumptions are based on, is there's a growing movement of collaboration that we think might have a trajectory to that billion board feet level. Changing federal policy is the only other alternative. And federal policy, when it comes to public lands, is hugely challenging to change. Chair Robler and I have had this conversation in the past. When you take these issues back to Washington, D.C., they're a Western lands issue. They're not an issue that most people east of the Mississippi River relate to, and for that reason, it becomes extremely difficult to change federal land policy. It's not a problem that a senator from Mississippi or Georgia or Florida has a lot of political capital in. And so it's I think realistically we're hoping to achieve a lot of things without significant change in policy, because we think policy would be difficult to change.
And I guess I'll say a couple things. One, I wanted to acknowledge the work that was done by the whole group and how much effort was put in from the county's perspective, the individual members, and from all of the staff in the governor's office and the executive branch bringing up different ideas. And I want to mention one in particular that came out of our little rural tour that we did on this committee, and that was continuing to talk about the real differences between some of these frontier counties with very little population and big expanses of deal. The conversation about roads, which is a biggie for them in particular, because they have this vast area that they need to transport stuff, and it has to do with our natural resource base in their community, and the fact that this group honed in and recognized that was one big area. And the other one was the final discussion that we had with regard to public health. And I hope an understanding about what equity is, which we came to find different when we were talking to those people. Equity was there. Could we provide the service at all? I mean, they wanted to be able to provide the service, and given the amount that they got on a per-person amount, they couldn't even provide a minimal service. And so we're having this real conversation about what does it have, like you said, in the general idea of the county, $160 per person. We're having that conversation there that says we need to provide for communicable diseases. We need to provide for prenatal stuff. There are some things that every county needs to do for the citizens that are in that county. And as a state, we need to help them through county health departments. And coming up with this baseline, and I know that's been a difficult thing for them to find, but how much does a county need before you start talking about how many people they have in the county, how many they have to get that nurse that they need and that other person. And I'm happy that this group, with its diversity, came to that same conclusion that we do need to look at those kinds of things. And that's just kind of a statement. And the other one, and having been one of those people who believes that we can harvest more than even the 1 billion and do it safely and efficiently, and I would hope that we continue to look for opportunities in our rural areas to use this resource we have. And the one that's been tweaking my interest the most lately is, you know, the pellet industry, which has become a really good way of using that resource that we have out there in abundance right now that we can't get into the federal forests to do. But most of the people don't want to come and invest in a plant to make those pellets without the assurance that they're going to have a resource. And so breaking this deadlock with respect to that federal forest lands so that we know that there is, for the long term, a way for them to build a plant, produce that material that can go. And there's a shortage worldwide for pellet manufacturing. And we have resources. So I hope that we continue to work on that one. And the last thing I want to offer, and then you can have any comments. There are 54 recommendations here, and some of those we know will be introduced by different branches, different groups, as part of their POPs and their other kinds of things in the process that's coming along. We, I think, on this committee would love to have anything that doesn't seem to find a home to bring back to the committee to look as a committee bill and others, and at least have those discussions about how to present and get it on the table, because we went through a lot of work in this committee, and the ones that are have been unanimously agreed to, I think all of us would say, I feel pretty comfortable. If you bring it back here, we'd look at that as an introduction as time goes on. So keep us in the loop with that. And I know that we will continue to push on the federal government to live up to their responsibility, which I agree with all of the members on this committee, is a federal responsibility. It's one they agreed to a long time ago, and they need to continue to hold. We need to continue to hold them to that. And I know I'll work with people on that one as well. And with that, I have a finger from Representative Kahn.
Well, I can't leave it at my comments at such a negative tone to them. What I do want to thank you for is the work from the counties that's gone into detailing the services that the actual on-the-ground services that are reduced. It's easy for us to look at, oh, well, there's not enough money and you just cut government, and to translate that into what it means to people in our communities, I think, is really important as we continue this never-ending public education effort. And public health has got to be the greatest example of it. I appreciate it coming up. Communicable disease control is important to me and to each and every one of us. I don't care whether I'm headed for Malheur County when I leave here today, and I don't care whether I'm eating in a restaurant in Malheur County or one in Lincoln County. I want to know that that restaurant has been inspected and that I'm not going to catch something over dinner. And that's important. That's bottom line stuff that we have to be able to do. So I appreciate you kind of putting it out in services. Public safety we focus on a lot as we talk about these, but there's some other bottom line stuff that counties have been doing for a long time and need to continue to do.
I could add one thing. The report is still an initial report. It's on the governor's website, and we're taking comments for a 60-day period ending August 22nd. By August, we'll also see the next iteration of the Western Oregon Plan revision from the BLM. And then we'll meet again in September as a task force, Representative, Senator, to absorb the recommendations, look at them, absorb the comments, and make changes as needed based on those comments, and issue our final report in September.
Okay. Arnie, last comment. Yeah.
One last comment that came out that I was just floored with, and that was greenhouse gas emissions. You talked about climate change. I always thought fossil fuels was by far the biggest contributor to greenhouse gases. The decay rate and forest fires put that to shame in a number of folds. And so we're talking about our forests producing between 11 and 17 million cars worth of gas fossil fuel burning. So I think it behooves us on not just economic reasons, but for environmental reasons, that we have to increase our production and the sequestering of carbon. And that wasn't brought up, and I just thought I'd throw that back. I know you like to harvest more trees, aren't you? And I agree with you.
Anyway, thank you all, and thanks for the work. We'll get back. So we'll close our public hearing on federal services, and we're going to open a public hearing on the economic assistance to salmon fishermen, so we can have people come up. And while we're moving and insisting, I do want to say that one of the comments that's come up from a member here, actually Representative Cowan, and has kind of worked its way through to a suggestion we'll talk about at the end of the meeting, is the idea of having us go on a rural tour, maybe if we can work it out with some other health people, to talk about the health conditions and the availability of access to health in these rural areas. We heard a little bit about it on our last tour, and I think it would behoove us to maybe invite some of our other friends from the other parts, the urban areas, to come out with us to see some of that, which was one of the recommendations that came out of our last trip. So we'll talk about that some more. And with that, thank you for being here.
Hi, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I want to extend apologies from Jessica Hamilton with the Governor's Office. She had to leave to a doctor's appointment. She's got her foot in a cast and needed to get there. So I'll take care of the federal portion of this and talk a little bit then about the state aid to the salmon fishers. A little bit of background, the announcement on the Sacramento River closure was done in April, and at that time, the governor put together an executive order directing several state agencies to work together to help mitigate this, as was done in 2006. Part of that was that the Oregon Department of Agriculture would be the primary agency for the state aid, as was done in 2006, and we're working on that again. Part of that is the congressional delegation, as such, worked to get $170 million for Oregon, Washington, and California in the Farm Bill. And currently they're working through what that distribution might be for the state. I was told last week it would be about $27 million for Oregon. That will be distributed by the Pacific Coast Marine Fisheries Council, as was done also in 06. The Salmon Commission has been meeting up and down the coast, doing informational meetings, trying to get recommendations from those affected by this to give to those folks for what they think the distribution should be. That's been forwarded to the Pacific Coast folks, and I know that the thought was that Oregon, Washington, California needed to kind of come to an agreement between those three commissions on what, how that distribution would be done. So there will be more on that, I think, in the next few weeks on what's ultimately decided. But good news that there was $27 million there. Regarding the state aid, certainly want to extend appreciation for the governor for extending $500,000 of strategic reserve funds, SRF funds, as well as the E-Board met last Friday and allocated an additional matching $500,000. So we have $1 million in state aid to distribute this time. That's what we had in 2006. There's a new group that's being added to this pool. It is the Ocean Charter fishers, those that actually do trips for fishing and take folks out versus the commercial salmon folks. So we are working with our advisory group. We've reconvened that group. It's made up of representatives from several state agencies, Department of Ag, Department of Administrative Services, Fish and Wildlife, Oregon State University. We've now included the Marine Board because of the Ocean Charter vessels, as well as Representative Krieger, Representative Boone, folks from the Ocean Charter industry, the Salmon Commission as well. That group's been invaluable for coming up with this distribution formula. We will be meeting July 11th and get that group together to go over the data that we have. We primarily used salmon landings for the commercial folks. Since we've not included the Ocean Charter folks before in this distribution, the Marine Board sent out an application process, and those were due at the end of May. They had 68 folks fill out those applications for aid, so we will be merging those two groups together with the data that we have then to come out with a distribution formula. Anticipate, I can tell you just briefly, in round one and round two that was put together in 2006, the average check was, those rounds combined was about $2,500. Since we're dealing with the same $1 million, I would anticipate it would be somewhere probably in that range by the time we're done. So with that.
Did you say 2,500?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We also, the people doing restoration of habitat, they are still hiring people, and they've given that priority continued for displaced fishermen and others.
Chair Roblin, it's my understanding that that's in the, currently in the works, yes.
Right. I felt pretty good about that. I was just hearing that three or four in our local area were being hired already, so I appreciate that, too. Any questions? Yes, Representative Cowell.
Probably not
specifically aimed at you, maybe just having listened to some of the conversations, I'm curious if a separate issue came up, and I suspect I'm not the only one that received this particular piece of mail. But the gist of it is concern from primarily the charter industry that the bad publicity around the lack of a salmon season this year has sort of led their business to drop off rather dramatically in all of the fisheries, because people don't realize there are still other fisheries that are going strong, and I see, since you have included the charter industry in this whole discussion, I'm suspecting this came up too, but it's basically a plea to the media to help folks understand that this just one kind of fish and there's other fish.
Yeah.
Did that come in the discussions at all?
Chair Roblin, Representative Cowan, absolutely did. In fact, I think early on that is one reason why ultimately the Salmon Commission is the one that brought forward, along with the governor's office, the recommendation to include those folks for that, some of those very reasons, that it, you know, it wasn't just that, it's that their entire income is going down. And part of the application process actually includes those factors about income related to other fisheries as well as salmon. So I think that's was certainly one of the factors.
It just might be helpful within press releases and that sort of thing. We could kind of help them focus a little bit on the fact that there are still ample opportunities for folks. You know, summer is young.
Yes. If there are lingcod out there, wonderful fish to eat, and halibut and other kinds of opportunities,
yes.
Although limited. Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I probably should have asked you for a break because I left the room for a very important reason.
Yes, okay.
And the person testifying doesn't look a thing like Jessica Hamilton.
I know. Jessica had to leave. Bad foot. Had a doctor.
I'm so sorry.
No problem. But he can answer some of Jessica's questions.
Well, I had a question, and if you covered this, I apologize. I'm sorry I was out of the room. But there's a very complicated issue around natural gas pipelines that affect my district. And there's a separate issue, although related, which is obviously the LNG terminals. So I want to always be very careful when I talk about this. I believe them to be related but separate. I'm asking about the LNG terminals and the whole idea that the, I think it's the Bradwood group that's proposing part of that project, is saying that they would also commit to or have committed to $59 million to go into the salmon, what is the Fish and Wildlife Foundation, to mitigate any salmon problems and to help with the whole issue. Do you have any comments on that, or if that actually happened, if it does move ahead, how would that fit into the recovery plan that the governor has?
Yeah, Chair Roblin and Representative Gilliam, unfortunately, I don't have that information. We'll have to get with Jessica and see if the governor's office knows more about that.
Okay.
And I'll do that for you.
Good. I'm interested in that. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good one. I wonder if you can find it out. Thank you. And thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for your efforts.
Yep.
Our local fishers appreciate it.
Yes, they do.
One other thing, Chair Roblin, I failed to mention, and if you get questions of this since this came up, we're anticipating that we'll get distribution checks in the mail, hopefully the latter part of July, first part of August, certainly. We wanted to wait until we had knew whether we were dealing with a half a million or a million, and since the e-board just acted, we'll do that.
That's good. Yeah, you want
to. Thank you for reminding me that I did have a question along those lines.
Yes, no, I appreciate that a lot.
Okay, the checks are going to be in the mail late July, early August. Is there an application that, I mean, just, I'm the salmon fisherman. What do I tell my salmon fisherman that says, how do I get my money?
Yeah. Chair Roblin, Representative Cowan, you need to tell them to, if they have questions about whether they're qualified or not, they can certainly call the Department of Agriculture. If they're ocean charter folks, they need to call the State Marine Board. But we have not asked the commercial folks to submit anything. We already have the data from 06. We've updated it. It's going to be easy for them if they qualify, and most of them know what that qualification is because the Salmon Commission's been working with them. They're already in the pool, and we'll try to get their checks. As far as the ocean charter, they've already gone through the application process. We've already got the 68, and we're ready. We just need to get the advisory group together to determine the distribution.
Okay. Thank you very much. So we'll close our public hearing on economic to salmon fishermen and open a public hearing on Short Line Railroads Overview. Kelly Taylor. And thank you for coming. We have had a lot of conversations in our committee about short line rail lines and rural policy because they definitely go together.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation Rail Division, and I'm here today to give you some basic information about railroads and then narrow it down and talk about short lines. And what you've got attached to my testimony is a map of the Oregon railroads, color-coded with short lines and the class ones, and I'll talk about the difference, and also a high-level assessment of the short lines. This is a snapshot in time, something I put together in December, so it's I'm going to be updating it shortly about Connect Oregon 2 and the distributions, but they're mentioned in here about people's applications. But let's just talk about railroads in general. I've got the introduction there. I mean, railroads really did help open up our country. And in fact, you know, when the rail lines are being laid and coming across the country, when towns found out they weren't going to be on the rail line, they would, like, in some cases, literally move overnight to go be next to the rail line.
Yeah.
And today we've got towns and cities grown up around them, and now people would sort of maybe wish sometimes that the rail line wasn't there. Maybe they could move it or go around the city, but they are where they are. The main point is they're critical partners in our past, and they're critical partners today. Economic development, moving goods. Rail statistics, in Oregon, we're served by 22 railroads. Two are the class ones, those are the big guns, if you will. Burlington Northern, BNSF Railway, and Union Pacific. And we have 20 short lines. And the main difference between the classifications is amount of revenue they make and the amount of the system that they maintain and operate. Short lines is a generic term. Generally means the small railroads, and we have 20 of them in Oregon, usually less than $40 million a year gross revenue and operating less than 350 miles a track. So let's just talk about short lines in general. I'm going to move over to page 2 of my testimony. The thing to understand is where do the short lines come from? Because really, it was mostly the big class ones that were around the country up until around 1980 when Congress deregulated the rail industry. And it's called the Staggers Act, 1980. And what's really left in regulation, rates and service are deregulated, much like some of the other transportation industries. But safety is still regulated, safety regulations. So we have inspectors at the rail division, and we enforce safety regulations, things like track condition, equipment, the rolling stock, locomotives, the cars, operating practices, hours of service, things like that. Almost all of the regulations are federally driven. The state has a few things that are state-driven that are not covered under federal regulations, but it's an interstate commerce. So much like the trucking industry, it's the same set of instructions and guidelines across the country. So it's mostly federal regulations that we're enforcing. Now, let's talk about short lines. When the Staggers Act passed and the Class 1s had the opportunity to move away from lines that were low density on business, not doing so well, they start doing that, and they start spinning them off in a form of abandonment, selling them. And that's where the short lines came from. These were folks who wanted to keep the rail line going, trying to be entrepreneurial. But what they did was they inherited lines that, again, low business density and usually deferred maintenance, a long time just barely making it by. So it's been an uphill battle for the short lines. There are some specific issues that I want to touch on that are you know, more short line than class one. And the difference between the two, again, because of revenue, I find that the class ones are really able to keep their track infrastructure in good condition, their tunnels, their bridges, their track. And when they have a catastrophic event like the Union Pacific, Oak Ridge, the snowstorm wiping out all their line, they've got the resources to go put it back into place. If they have a bridge collapse, they have the resources to go put it back in place. The class ones tend to have trouble with capacity issues because they operate in so many states with so many competing interests. It's difficult for them to put this project, get the money, pencil it out, and get that project done to relieve congestion or something. But they do have money to keep their track in place. This is where the short lines don't. Car loads, how many cars per mile that you handle is a keen indicator of how healthy your rail line is. And I have some, I'm going to talk about the chart in a minute, and I'll show you what I mean by that. Where the short lines have the difficulty is keeping their track infrastructure up to date and heavy enough rail to support the industry-weighted cars today. 286,000 pounds is the industry-weighted car standard. We call them 286 for short. And so they have difficulty generating enough revenue to cover operating, let alone maintenance, especially on a line that had deferred maintenance for a long time. We've got tunnels and bridges that are aging on the rail line, much like we have on our highway system. The legislature, you know, put money forth in the Transportation Investment Act to upgrade highway bridges. Well, we've got bridge issues and tunnel issues on the short lines. There are hundreds of bridges in the rail system in Oregon, hundreds of bridges, from culverts, crossings to giant bridges, and they're aging. Most of them built in the 40s and 50s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. Timber trest bridges, not concrete and steel, and they're starting to age. They're starting to show their age. They were built well and built sturdy, almost overbuilt, if you will, but again, age and Mother Nature starts, you know, playing havoc on some of those. Tunnels. There are 69 tunnels in the Oregon rail system, and 34 of them are on the short line. And these tunnels mostly date back between the late 1800s and 1916. So they're coming up on 100 years old. We've got bridges that are coming up on 100 years old. And again, built well, but again, age catching up with them. Now, the issue that we have, I was talking about the 286 cars, is you need a certain weight of rail. And rail is when they talk about, oh, that's 110-pound rail, that's 125, they mean in a 3-foot stretch in a yard. How heavy is that rail? And you need 110-pound or better to be really capable of handling the industry standard car of 286. And we have, let's see, what have I got in here? About 80% of our short lines and our rails can handle that. But we have 20%, majority, 62 to 90 pound rail. So, I mean, we have some rail out there that was laid in the late 1800s still. Very, very small rail. And so what that means is when you're dealing with timber or something, there's some mills up on the Mill City branch just outside of Salem that, those companies have regenerated those mills, are doing quite well, but they really need to put their stuff on rail. Truck doesn't work very well for them economically. Well, the rail cars can't be filled to capacity because they'd be too heavy. So the shippers have actually been donating money to help put ties and things into that rail line in order to get the rail line beefed up to handle their cars efficiently. Some of the Connect Oregon 1 projects actually helped retrofit some of the short lines to bring them up to 286. And on those lines, they're now able to fill those rail cars to capacity, which is much more efficient than sending cars down the line only half filled, both for the shipper and for the railroad. Let's see where I'm at. I'm going to go off to page 3 here, under rail funding. The thing about it is, we're talking about bridges aging, tunnels aging. Now, and the thing that's different about the rail system from the highway system, we have a good inventory of bridges and tunnels on the highway system. We don't have a good inventory of the bridges and tunnels on the rail system. Most of it privately owned. Again, class ones, the big guns, they've got a good inventory. The short lines don't. The legislature last session, the full session in 07, allocated $2 million in my budget to do a rail study to help fill the gap of knowledge about the rail system because of some of the issues that have been happening, and with short lines having difficulty or not being able to handle shippers in certain areas, shutting down altogether in other areas. And one of the first things we're doing, we actually have contracts that we're underway with to do a study of the bridges and tunnels on the short lines. Now, we don't have enough money to look at all bridges, so what we're going to do is look at the very large bridges. All bridges over 100 feet. All wooden bridges over 100 feet, and any steel and concrete bridge. Because that's where if you've got a problem, that's going to be your most expensive ticket to try to fix. So we're doing that, and I must tell you that the railroads so far have been extremely cooperative, giving us any of the reports they have themselves for the consultants to look at to try to glean information and see if there's any gaps there in the reports. They're being very cooperative and allowing us to come onto property to go to do the inspections. But rail funding. Rail is one of the most capital-intensive industries that there are. 18 to 20% of the revenue is needed to put back into capital, compared to some of the other industries that are like 3 and 4%. To cost the upgrade rail to get it to 286 is estimated at $250,000 to $300,000 per mile. Now, compared to to a highway, it's less. But if you're not making enough money and you're in this on your own, it can be very difficult to ever have that money to ever upgrade, which is why, like on the Mill City line, the shippers have been chipping in. We estimate that upgrading the, say, 460 or so miles of track that cannot handle 286 is somewhere between 115 and 138 million. And that goes up all the time because steel is just really, really increasing in price. And ties are too, as a matter of fact. Now, there have been funding in the last several sessions for the first time for rail. The Oregon legislators have heard from the different shippers and different lines and have been helping. In both the 01 and the 03 session, $2 million each session towards short lines, just for short lines and for rail rehabilitation for that. In 05, there was the industrial rail spurs for $8 million. But the big ticket item that's really, really making a difference is Connect Oregon, frankly. Connect Oregon 1 and 2. In Connect 1, nearly $28 million was awarded to projects that benefit short lines. Now, this may be a Class 1 project, the short line uses that line, or maybe strictly for the short line. And in the Connect 2 that the commission just gaveled down on is $32 million benefiting the short lines. And some of those are, like, upgrading to 286. On the Mill City line, all of the bridges on the Mill City branch are going to be either retired because they can be filled in, they're small, or repaired. So that every bridge on that line is going to be dealt with. Because they've got, I think it's like $3.8 million or so of Connect Oregon money. So, I mean, that really helps those shippers that are on that line that have been trying to do it themselves with ties, but the bridges are expensive. Now, what I want to do is talk to you about this chart a little bit and help you understand what it is. I apologize for the small print. There's a lot of information on it. But I'm going to take, when you look at it, I'm on the first page. I've got the name of the railroad to begin with, like just reading at the top, Albany and Eastern. And underneath there, before the line, is their branches. And reading across, how many, so I'm just going to read the Albany and Eastern line. How many miles do they own or lease? In 06, what was the gross revenue for the entire railroad? What's the revenue per mile? How many carloads in that year? How many carloads per mile? And that's going to be real important in just a second. How many tunnels they have? How many bridges they have over 100 feet. What is the Federal Railroad? That's what FRA stands for, Federal Railroad Administration. What is the class of the track? The higher the number, the better quality track, the faster you can go. Accepted means absolutely not even on the scale. It's not even a 1 or a 2. There's 1 through 9. Accepted means it's not even 1. It's the lowest it is. I mean, they've got some real problems. They're having to do slow orders and things like that, go very, very slow over the bridges, very, very slow over the track to try to hold it together and not bust it up. How many miles of rail is less than 110 pounds? That's kind of your indicator of how much, whether or not they're really handling 286 or not. And again, then whether they are. They may be, but they're going very slow to do it. And then just over in comments, just some general things that we knew about the short line in December, like, you know, annual carloads, how they're doing, what sort of money they've gotten from the feds or from the state to help them, whether or not the shippers are kicking in or not, if we knew of that. Now, at the very last sheet, at the bottom, is a footnote, carloads per mile, and this is where this comes in. This is from a 1993 Interstate Commerce Commission pamphlet, Something to Know Before You Start a Small Railroad. Talking about the annual carloads per mile is a good indicator of the health of your business and whether or not you're going to have enough to cover operations and maintenance. And as you see there, anything below 25, your viability is unlikely. And you go on, 20 to 25, the line may be successful if the railroad's not responsible for track maintenance and taxes. For example, the track is owned by a government, which assumes these responsibilities. 50 to 100, chances for success are good if other conditions for success are favorable. And over 100 carloads per mile, success is almost always assured, assuming other conditions are normal. Now, given that, I'd like to flip back to, say, the first page and look at the Central Oregon and Pacific. You with me on this? Okay, so I'm looking on the first page, and the bottom half is the Central Oregon and Pacific. Now, they have three branches. They have the Siskiyou line, the Coos Bay line, and the White City branch. And we just happen to have a breakdown of their carloads and things just because of some of the current conversations that have been going on. But look at them overall, the top line where it says Central Oregon Pacific. If you look at carloads per mile, they have 117 per mile. And you know, that's, according to that chart, a pretty good indicator they should be okay. Now, they do have, and we noted on the side, it's not your typical on some of those lines railroad because of the steep grades and the curves and the mountains and things. Port Tillamook Bay is another railroad that has some challenges because of the storms and such that they have, the amount of the weather events. But overall, they should be just fine. Now, if you look individually at their lines, the Siskiyou line, 159 cars per mile, carloads per mile, Coos Bay Branch, 43. And that's where a railroad will say, well, you know, that particular branch isn't pulling its weight. But overall, the company is doing enough to maintain. It's just that sometimes railroads resist taking money from one line to help subsidize and pay for another. And so they want to spin that particular line off. And I think that's what we've got going on in the Central Oregon and Pacific, the Corp as it's known. But you will see when you go through here, some of them are in very good shape and some of them are not so good shape. I will tell you, it is possible to turn it around. The city of Prineville is a good example, and Representative Gilman knows this very well. When I came on board in this particular job in 2004, the one thing I heard was the city of Prineville is probably going to go under. And I said, why? And they said they have no carloads. In that entire year, and they've got 20 miles or so that they maintain, they shipped only 84 cars in a whole year. They're up to over 1,000 now. They have turned it around. Their vision of a freight depot where they collect and can bring in truckloads to rail, rail to truck, and some storage and warehousing, and building on that 32 acres. Companies are coming there and building. A truss company came and built there, and they not only build their trusses, they then put them on the rail. So they've turned it around, and the Connect Oregon 1 and 2 is going to finish out that freight depot, and the governor and Representative Gilman were just there last week celebrating this. I mean, it truly is a model for some of the short lines. Now, that model may not work in all areas of the state, but we are looking at that with that $2 million rail study that the legislature allocated. We are looking at what are the business trends and models that are going to change the way business happens in Oregon, and can we get in front of it? Is there some way to mitigate it? I believe fuel costs are going to change things dramatically with how we see things happening on the rail. Whether it's truck and, you know, whether, you know, we're already hearing that companies are thinking they're going to be moving away from the just-in-time and going back to doing some storage of goods so that they don't have to go as far and don't have to rely on the trucking right there or the rail. Bring it in more, have it there in stock, and then move it out. So I mean I'm hearing that from some of the railroads that they're thinking it's going to change the paradigm quite a bit about how things are hauled and what things are hauled. It may change the typical markets on what you do a transload. I mean, lumber typically transloads, but we may see some of the bulk items and then change to a different way of doing business. The short lines do have a challenge. They inherited lines that didn't have dense business, and if they haven't been able to build up their business, they haven't been able to maintain their rail lines. And frankly, a line that can't handle 286 is just a matter of time before it's not going to be there because it won't be able to keep up. I will tell you with the Port of Tillamook Bay, you know, their line's been out of service since December from the storm, and they're in the middle of going through a FEMA assessment, the assessment to help FEMA assess what the damage is equal to, et cetera. So that's as much information I have right now about the Port of Tillamook Bay. That's supposed to be done, I think, in early September. And then FEMA will be able to say, okay, the damage is worth X, and now your match is 25% should you try to put it back. The Central Oregon and Pacific, it's clear that company is headed towards abandonment of that line. They have filed a pre-notice with the Federal Surface Transportation Board, the oversight board, that replaced the ICC, the Interstate Commerce Commission. It's the Surface Transportation Board. That's where you go. Because they're granted authority to have common carrier obligation, they must get permission to stop. They don't, it's not, as somebody said to me, it's not like a dry cleaner or a restaurant where you can simply just go out of business. You were granted an obligation. You must now get permission to have that rescinded. So it's going to be a while before you know exactly where all the cards fall on Central Oregon Pacific.
And they may talk about the one line, but it's they would only do a abandon part of that line, and so the other part would still be actively working. Right?
Yes, they have talked about they had the first 13 miles out of Eugene. They still have a shipper prior to getting to the tunnels that caused them to close it, and so they're actually just trying to abandon the last part of the line, the last 80 or so miles, not the whole line.
Which makes it difficult for another short line to want to come in.
It makes it very difficult. Being a short line behind a short line is not a lucrative thing to do. No.
Yeah, exactly. And the same is true on their Siskiyou line.
Correct.
They're really only talking about abandoning it past other side of Medford.
Actually. Yeah, yeah. They try to break it up to just keep the lucrative piece and shed the piece that's not so lucrative. And so it remains to see what the Surface Transportation Board is going to do about that.
Okay. Other questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you. I really appreciate it. It's nice to have a succinct little...
You're welcome.
Yeah. On short line.
This is very helpful. Now I've finally figured out what a short line is.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Gil.
We don't have one. I wasn't familiar with the distinctions.
Oh, okay.
Into.
Yeah, you aren't on the map.
Yeah, I know. I'm just not on the map there.
Brent. We'll close that public hearing, and we'll open public hearing on Oregon Telecommunications Legislative Proposal. And thanks for waiting for this and being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Speaking of succinct and short, I will keep it succinct and short, I hope. My name is Brant Wolf. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Telecommunications Association. I've spoken to most members of the committee, and I apologize, Senator Girard. I wasn't aware of your presence here today, so I haven't spoken to you about this.
You're not on the committee.
He's never on our committee.
He's kind of an honorary member.
All right, ex officio.
He's one of our, yes, he's our ex officio.
Okay. So, to recap, I'm coming to the committee today with two different proposals, and they surround or have to do with my members, the small independent telephone companies, as well as the larger members of my association, Embark and CenturyTel, Embark being the former Sprint, if you're not familiar with that, and their carrier of last resort obligations. And in short, what that means is they are assigned a territory which they must serve, and everyone in it must be served by that company. What we're seeking here today is, in the event of certain resort developments where an exclusive agreement for telecommunications services has been signed with a company that's not what is the incumbent local exchange carrier, or the wireline company, but maybe a competitor. It could be a cable company or just a separate telephone company that's been created to serve that community. In that case, if the development continues on, the small telephone companies, the wireline companies, the traditional phone company is frozen out of the development at the gate. And they cannot get in, they can't get an easement to put the facilities in the ground or any of the things that you would need to do in the development stage of that area. So, my members would like to be able to petition the commission for an exemption from their carrier of last resort obligations within the confines of that resort development. Or, you know, if that can't happen, then another option would be to prohibit the signing of exclusive agreements in these areas. And those are the two options I've laid out there on my testimony. And in my opinion, the situation is right for one of those two to take place. And we would like the opportunity, my members, to work this issue during the 2009 session. So what I would like to do is ask this committee for permission to go to Legislative Council and get two bill drafts dealing with those two separate options on your paper there. I know we've all talked about this. I've spoken with each of you individually, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have. I did come with an example, if you'd like to hear of an example of where this has happened. I don't want to take a lot of your time, so if we don't need to do that, I won't do it. I'm open for any kind of question, sir.
Right. So the question here is this something that we want to take up as a committee bill? We could actually have both drafted and then decide later if we want to introduce them as committee bills. Do we want to, if other than that, then people may end up taking it as an individual and work with Brent. But in his conversation with me, he was interested in having us as a committee consider this. These are mostly issues that take place in rural areas.
Exactly.
And that's why it seems sensible to come here. And it is one that I think puts some of our rural providers in real difficult times. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is they go in with these great intentions, they do their thing, and then all of a sudden they drop the contact with the other one, and they come back to the person who is, quote, the required provider, and now they have to do something, which could include tearing up roads and doing all sorts of other stuff to put in as something that could have been done earlier at the other.
At great expense.
At great expense, yeah. Everybody. So, questions?
Just, Mr. Chair, just one real quick point of order. It's been so long since I was the chairman of a committee.
I understand that.
Like, never.
What are we going to be? Didn't we let you be chair once?
That's when he was right-handed.
What are the limitations or the possibilities for our for a committee bill, as you understand them, in 09?
In general, if what has happened in the past, both when I was the vice chair with Patty Smith as the chair and then as the chair, that as we get closer, and a lot of times the chair makes that decision on their own, I tend to be one of those that opens it up to everybody, but we'll look at different kinds of things. We'll talk with our committee administrator. We'll then decide that these are some things that really fit into what we think our committee is about. We ask Legislative Council to draft them, and in the last meeting prior to coming into session, we'll look at all those and we'll make a decision whether we're going to introduce them as committee bills. Oftentimes that takes place it takes place formally, but a lot of times people will acquiesce and just say, yeah, we'll just introduce all these as committee bills. And then eventually they come back and we decide which ones are really going to work in the session. Some get worked, some don't. But there has been, I think, and I think Representative Girard, Senator Girard, I could explain that, but it's been, because he was here even in a previous iteration, that once the committee group decides we're going to put those bills in, there's not a whole lot of discussion on it. We kind of hammer them in, and then they go finish up getting them ready for the session. And they could be a great number or very few by committee. The thing that's been nice about committees is that it is a committee bill. Therefore, it comes out. It's not an individual. It's more a bipartisan type thing when they eventually come out. And I think that's been the case. That's not always the case. But any addition to that?
Well, no, I think you did a very good job. But I think the workability with the chair is what determines how flexible it is.
I mean, that's probably true.
And chair, I think you will be very flexible.
Well, under that description, I would, if you're asking for our opinion,
right.
I'm very interested in this moving forward as a committee bill.
Okay. Any?
Well, I think that this is definitely an important issue for rural communities because I want them to have the service provided. I guess I'm just wrestling with the concept of developing two bills, or should we narrow our preference to which of those? And I would have to tell you, if you want to pursue two, that's fine, and we could decide. But I'm leaning more towards the idea of banning exclusive agreements in order to give people a chance to put in the infrastructure up front if necessary, than the exemption from obligation. And my reason for that is I don't want to leave some of our rural constituents out there not getting the service and not having a provider of last resort to go to.
Yeah, and I guess I would like to hear your suggestion with regard to where many of your people are feeling.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the reason for the two options, initially I approached the situation just strictly as an exemption. If we are being barred from the development, we would like to be exempt from our obligation. In conversations with the Public Utility Commission, they shared the same concerns that you did, Representative Cowan. It was pretty far-reaching on my part, I admit. I just wanted us to be able to say we're exempt without any kind of process. They didn't go for that. So,
nice try.
Yeah. The second step was saying, okay, then we go through a petition process where we petition the commission, they do the fact-finding investigation, all the parties are at the table, and there's a decision made. Yes, you are exempt, or no, you're not exempt. And the commission makes that decision, and there's a record made for that decision. And we're okay with that. We're fine with that. And I think that would lay some groundwork to provide for people to be to have their service in the future. During the course of that conversation, commission staff indicated to me that the FCC had recently addressed this situation by just prohibiting it altogether in certain situations, and they suggested maybe we mirror that instead. I had to socialize that entirely with my members. I think we could go either way. And in my opinion, and the committee can do, we would be happy with either one. But in my opinion, it would just be helpful to me as I'm working the issue, I think, to say it's either or. I mean, if it's not one, then you have to give us the other. You can't leave us in the middle. And that's just how I envisioned kind of working the bill. In addition to that, I've had some problems with prohibition bills in the past. We've tried to prohibit certain things in the past, and people have some philosophical problems with prohibiting things, just generally speaking. So that's my only hesitation with going that way. But I'm willing to work it that way. I certainly am.
Well, I will leave it to the chair's discretion, and I understand your desire to have, well, it's either or.
Right.
My bottom line is I don't want to do anything that's going to leave some customers hanging out there who can't get service.
And I guess my only other concern is that if we take the other option, that, you know, the option two, which would prohibit the exclusive ones, that does mean you will have to put an infrastructure in. And
yes.
It will cost money.
That's true.
Which you may not get to regroup because, I mean, that, and depending on how small some of these groups are, it makes me concerned about their viability if they have to go and get the stuff in there without any customers to
right.
begin with.
It is difficult to compete when there's only 100 customers to compete for. It can be difficult.
So that's why I get in this dilemma of knowing what's the best. In areas even our size, it's not as bad. But if I'm in one of those really rural areas that they are now talking about having these resorts come into, their whole telephone company may have 100 mm-hmm. people. And now there's this new development that's going to have another 100 possibilities, which is doubles their size. And they could end up having to put an infrastructure in for that without getting any, even if they have the non-exclusive, without ever getting enough to pay for the infrastructure they put in.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Callan, I mean, if I can provide any kind of reassurance to you, we will certainly work with the Public Utility Commission. We are not interested in abandoning people at all. I mean, that's just not what we're after here. We're just after some equity. If we're being told that we can't serve this community, then we don't want to be on the hook if, in fact, one or two people inside the development say, we're not satisfied with what we're getting here. You have to service. You have to come in and give us this service despite the fact that you weren't allowed in the street from the beginning.
I guess it might be wise to work both of them, and the rest of the discussion we can have as we work the bills.
Right.
But I will just tell you what my bottom line is going to be. So assurance that people know up front what
right.
their options for utility access.
Mm-hmm.
And if they sign it and say, hey, this is the only one I'm going to work with, if they go away, I'm stuck, as long as they know up front. But
I agree with what you're saying. The problem that has happened in the past in some of the same situations is that the people who actually signed the agreement did understand it, but
exactly.
three sellers later, it was
Precisely.
Left off the agreement. You know, the fact that that was part of the agreement wasn't even on the deed. And I said, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And that's the part that is scary anytime you do that kind of prohibition thing. So what I'm hearing here, and I guess I don't really need to take a formal action, I will have work with our committee administrator to get both of them drafted. I think having watched the system work, both when you're in the majority or in the minority, oftentimes having a backup plan is helpful in the negotiations that go forward to coming up with the bill that works. And as I understand this situation, we really need something out of the 2009. There is no alternative to wait longer. So we need to come with something this session to address this problem.
Thank you. I agree.
Okay. So we will do that. And I thank you for coming.
Thank you for indulgence. I appreciate it.
Thanks. So we'll close this little hearing, and the next order of business is just to talk about this committee. And I feel very strongly that if there are issues that people on the committee would like to bring up, I would like to hear them, and we'll try to get them worked into the our interim discussions. We're looking at a couple more meetings when I look at the whole schedule, and one may be this trip. that what I was talking about. And I think we could do some things with regard to DHS when we're out there and health issues, access and so on, if we do a short one, and invite some other people to come along with our committee. And then we'll do another one when we start talking about committee bills. And intervening, I would hope that people, if you have ideas you would like to be considered for those kinds of things, get a hold of me, and we'll try to work whatever we can with different people's deals on committee bills as well. Yes?
I just want to clarify a little bit. The contact that I had from OHSU interest in talking about some of these rural health issues was sort of the other way around. Rather than us making a trip to them, to the rural communities, their concept was that some of the more rural legislators host some of their compatriots in the rural areas and have them have a chance to do some one-on-one conversation with the rural health providers. And I don't know which way would work best. I'm always willing to take the road trip.
My issue is that I was, when after we had talked, and then I had conversations with some other people who had talked to me earlier about how do we get people from urban areas and others out to these rural areas to actually see the difficulties they're having with providing some of these services that they take for granted, whether it's health clinics or whatever that we don't have in some of these rural areas, and they do. How are we providing Oregon Health Plan services to our people? Because it's very different than how they're being provided in some of these other places. So they start to get a better understanding and have those people. My issue about having a committee meeting is we can set it up, we can have some pre-work done, we can have some people come and show them who are right there in the local communities and have them sit at the panel. It's kind of like what we did in our other one, except we didn't bring as many people with us. That I think, you know, when we kept having our little rural show, they kept saying, wait, we're talking to people who already understand some of our issues. Wouldn't it be nice to have a few of those others? And I think that came up a couple times in our other rural trip.
I guess maybe that's part of it. I'd love to make the trip again. I just want to make sure that we get some people to listen to it that need to hear it. So, you know, whether they have to be handcuffed or, you know, or whatever.
Not talking to the converted.
So working out one or the other. So let's think about that. Because the other option would be to have it here and bring those people to us. And I think there's a lot of them that would make the trip.
Yeah, it's asking a lot, though.
But it is asking a lot. And sometimes I think it's nice to go out to them. We got a lot of positives from people who said, you know, we haven't had many people come out and visit us and really understand our plight.
Yeah. I got to tell you, and I'm sorry, I shouldn't right. probably.
No.
I got a lot out of that trip.
Go ahead.
And I thought I, being a rural legislator, I thought I was pretty well equipped with the knowledge that I needed. And I took away quite a bit out of that trip, and I found it quite enjoyable.
Oh, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Under that subject, I wrote you a note, and it's not to discuss now, but I just want to remind that Representative Callan and I heard an update at the Health Human Services Committee about models for addressing child welfare cases involving domestic violence, and it really was kind of shocking, and it fits into what...
Exactly. I mean, that was another part of the whole thing when I was having...
I just want to be sure.
Well, thank you. Yes.
And the second one that I hope we could possibly look at is... Bees are dying, and it's a huge problem for agriculture.
I don't like bees.
I know. But we
did write a letter. I wrote a letter to and talked to our people at the bee board, encouraging them to fund the study, which I believe did happen.
It did. Okay. I didn't notice.
I want to make sure. But I'll have to go back.
It came out of bee board.
Okay.
That was the way I read it. Yeah.
So I was unaware.
I'm hopeful that is continuing, because that is a very big issue to any of us. And
In
the state of Oregon, it's not just rural, but it's definitely a rural issue. But
yes, but it's for the whole state.
Yeah.
Right. And lastly, I was so glad that you both had Senator Girod here, and that you highlighted his previous service. I don't think he was in the room. I thought the previous testifier on short railroads, short lines, was talking about him when she said, you know, originally built very sturdy, but Mother Nature is taking its toll.
And I realized it was the short line and not Fred that she was talking
about. Thank you.
This is your peer. I don't know what to tell you, Fred.
Hey, I left him behind. He sticks with
me. I think we better turn off the cameras.
It's about that time. So any other comments or suggestions? Again, I encourage people to keep in contact with us if there's issues.
Do you have a date set for another
meeting? Do not have a date set, but we'll get around to people as we get closer to that. We know that they will not be in July, probably not August, so we're looking probably September.
Okay.
Okay, so we have the rest of the summer off.
So with that, we will
nothing else going on.
Close our hearing. Of